Good Monday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you've joined us today. Hope you had a fantastic weekend. Got a great show for you. Cheryl Todd is going to join us on the program from Gun Freedom Radio. She has written a column, Don't Be a Butt. B-U-T. She says Whoopi Goldberg is a butt. The trendy mustachioed guy wearing the Feel the Burn t-shirt at the organic grocery store is a butt. The herd of fake conservatives from Everytown for Gun Safety are butts. They say, I own a gun, but. Before they expose themselves and foul the air with the propaganda. She says that phrase, I support the right to own a gun, but, is a telltale warning for the misinformation and ignorance to follow. It's a really good column. We'll talk about it with Cheryl Todd later in the hour. Sean Maloney of Buckeye Farms Association on the anatomy of a gun buyback program, a buyback that gun owners might actually be able to get behind, because the guns aren't destroyed. The guns aren't melted down. The guns are actually sold to federal firearms licensees who then turn around and find those guns a good home. Now, again, is this done as a crime reduction effort? Is it successful in that regard? Probably not, because the research shows that these programs don't do anything to reduce crime. But it is an interesting twist on the compensation program. Michael Barone of the Washington Examiner is going to join us next hour. The Iowa caucuses today. Those of you tuning in on Sirius XM Patriot 125, congratulations. You already know the winner. Whereas as we're recording this program, we do not. But we do know this. We are in the midst now of the primary season. In fact, a month from today, Virginia will hold its primary along with a number of other states. We'll talk with Michael Barone again, his guide to the Republican primaries. Bob Owens of Bearing Arms says, welcome to Obama's legacy, gang warland. Number of cities, you know, in 2015 saw an increase in violent crime. FBI says overall in the first 6 months of 2015, violent crime up 1.5%. Bob was at the SHOT Show, the Shooting, Hunting, Outdoor Trade Show in Las Vegas, Nevada, and he said one of the more interesting series of conversations that he had was with a highly placed NGO, non-governmental organization official, about the chilling effect that attacks on law enforcement have had on proactive policing. Bob, he said, the Ferguson effect is very real. Good officers are leaving the job as fast as they can retire. The only reason younger officers aren't leaving faster is that there isn't a clear transition from law enforcement to the normal workforce for a lot of people. There was a story I saw in the Chicago newspapers today about the number of stops that are being affected by officers on the street declining dramatically in Chicago. Chicago also just saw 51 homicides in January. That is a record for January, but stops are down. One of the chief reasons for this, according to the Chicago papers, is that based on a settlement with the ACLU, officers now, when they make any sort of contact whatsoever with someone, if it's a traffic stop, you pull somebody over, you grab somebody off the corner because you think they're selling drugs, whatever. No longer are you filling out a one-page report. Now you're filling out a two-page report. So in essence, your paperwork has doubled for every contact that you initiate. It's at least doubled. Again, there may be supplemental reports that have to be filed if the individual ends up being arrested, things like that. But for every stop now, your paperwork has doubled. So if your paperwork doubles, are you going to want to continue doing and making as many stops as you were before? Are you going to maybe look for those stops that appear more likely to result in writing a citation or making an arrest? Don't know. But we do know that the long arm of the law is reaching out and touching suspected criminals a lot less in Chicago. And violent crime is on the way up. Hard to believe that it could go up in Chicago, but unfortunately, 2016 off to a very bad start. Coming up in hour three, Mr. Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joining us for the Liberty Update. Jazz Shaw of Hot Air on the rarely discussed support for gun rights among black voters. Well, it's rarely discussed because the mainstream media doesn't really want to talk about stuff like that. Remember, if you are a Second Amendment supporter, according to the purveyors of most of our media today, you are a slack-jawed, drooling, inbred yokel, right? You're not allowed to be anything other than that. Any other kind of gun owner just doesn't exist for the purveyors of opinion in much of our media spectrum. The reality in this country is far different. And again, a lot of Americans feel very disconnected and out of touch with those purveyors of opinion for this, among many reasons. They truly don't want to understand the people who make up their prospective audience in too many cases. But we'll talk about it with Jazz Shaw. We also have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by our friends at AdCorp Defense. The Deal of the Day. I think actually we've got Heroes of the Day today. The Deal of the Day, just one, but it is a doozy of a story for you. And our Good Guy of the Day coming up at the top of Hour 3 as well. We'll get to the latest Second Amendment news and information throughout the program. But right before the show started, I was perusing the Internet, and I ran across this piece today by Robert Greenwald, who is a filmmaker. And he has a movie coming out. He calls it a documentary. It is called Making a Killing, Guns, Greed, and the NRA. And he's got a piece at Huffington Post right now. His argument, his assertion, if the snack industry was like the gun industry, we would be even fatter. Cam, you would be even fatter if the snack industry was like the gun industry. Well, first of all, I'm working on it, Robert, all right? So just cut me some slack here. But second of all, this is one of the most absurd arguments that I have seen. And I see pretty bad arguments in favor of gun control on a daily basis as the host of this program. I generally don't even single out this stuff, but this is just awful. He says, imagine what our lives would look like if for the last several decades the snack food industry had put a portion of every bag of chips ever purchased into a fund set aside strictly to promote and preserve your personal right to crunch. Over the years, they spent that money advertising, lobbying, and funding political candidates, all the while warning the public that the government was trying to take away your right to enjoy pretzels with your football and beer. They stoked fear, claiming that militant health foodies were taking over and that the government was coming to confiscate your Pringles. They appealed to your core values. This isn't just about the right to cheese doodles, but about your God-given right as Americans to put Doritos in your kids' lunch bags. Why, that's just crazy, isn't it? The snack food industry would never have done that. And they were inventing this threat, right? I mean, there was never a group out there in the 60s and 70s, for instance, the National Council to Ban Cheese Doodles. I don't think. There was, however, in the 1970s, the National Council to Ban Handguns. And they really did ban handguns in Washington, D.C., and they really did ban handguns in Chicago, and they really did put a ballot initiative before voters in Massachusetts in 1976 to ban handguns. That lost, by the way. There really was a movement out there a couple of generations ago that was honest about its mission and its intent. And when it failed, they didn't change their mission or intent. They just rebranded as gun violence prevention groups. And now they're trying to rebrand as gun safety groups. And, yeah, their demands right now have sort of shrunk down because Americans continue to say no to what it is that they are selling. But they have been pushing for this. And again, even today, you've got the New York Times. New York Times, I don't think, has ever run a front page editorial calling for the banning of most commonly owned snack foods. But they recently did run their first front page editorial in 95 years, calling for the banning of many commonly owned firearms. So here's the first problem with Greenwald's piece. It denies reality. It denies that there is, in fact, an anti-gun movement, has been for generations, and is pretty well funded by the former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, right now. And if you are an anti-gun advocate who refuses to acknowledge that your side exists because you want to try to portray the other side as just, you know, again, truly awful people, you're not making a documentary. You're not. It might look like one, but it's not a documentary. Anyway, he says, far-fetched as this sounds, it's a pretty much textbook version of the strategy gun manufacturers and sellers have been using for decades. In turn, he says, that strategy is why 88 Americans are killed every day with guns. It is the story we tell, he says, in Making a Killing, Guns, Greed, and the NRA, the latest feature from Brave New Films, which will be released in March. He says, Sturm, Ruger & Company donates $2 to the NRA for every gun sold. Taurus offers a year's free NRA membership to anybody who buys a gun. Crimson Trace, which makes laser sights, donates 10% of its sales to the NRA. All that money, he says, and millions more from similar sources spent scaring Americans into believing that their neighbors are dangerous, their government is out to get them, and their values are being threatened. Actually, you know, that actually sounds like the argument used by the anti-gun groups these days. You saw the Everytown ad with Rachel Dratch, right? The one where they go out to eat and, oh my gosh, there's a guy with a shotgun at the bar and there's somebody with an AR and he's eating pizza and we're just going to leave now. What is Moms Demand Action trying to do if not scare the bejeebers out of Americans about concealed carry holders? Your neighbors are dangerous, right? Anyway, he says, if back to our analogy, this had been the snack food industry at work, you wouldn't see calorie counts or nutritional information on your groceries. Well-paid constitutional scholars would claim that the right to remain ignorant about what you are eating is fundamental to the First Amendment. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would be barred from studying the health effects of sodium and food additives. No, they would be barred from conducting research that was designed to promote the banning of food additives and sodium. Because, again, the CDC can conduct research into gun violence right now. What it can't do is conduct propaganda for gun control. Anyway, he says school lunches would not just be allowed but required to serve chips. Uh-huh. Frito lovers would buy and hoard cartons of the stuff just in case. The people who make and sell snacks would make millions. Because, you know, they don't right now. And I'm sorry, this is where the argument just completely falls apart. Let me throw some numbers at you right now, because Mr. Greenwald here says this, you know, snack food industry, oh my God, look at the gun lobby. Oh, can you imagine what this would be like? We'd just be forced to eat Cheetos at every meal. This is from civileats.com, August 19th, 2015. Elizabeth Grossman reporting. The food industry is spending an enormous amount of money to promote and lobby for legislation that would prevent state and local governments from requiring labeling of GMOs, remove country of origin label requirements for most of the meat we buy, and make it harder to know where pesticides are used. Food companies may have shelled out over $100 million in the first 6 months of 2015 alone, according to federal lobbying disclosure reports. Huh. God, it sounds like the food industry is taking some of their money that comes in and using it to try to influence legislation. $100 million in the first 6 months of 2015. Okay. So how does that compare to the gun lobby and the gun manufacturers and this cycle of greed and killing that Mr. Greenwald says is happening? This is from Pacific Standard Magazine, December 2nd, 2015, Frenzy Deep. How much more money do gun rights lobbyists spend than gun control ones? That's an awful headline, by the way. She says this year, gun control groups spent $1.2 million on lobbying. Now, she's wrong about that because Bloomberg, oh, I'm sorry, on lobbying, not on elections, excuse me, lobbying. This year, gun control groups spent $1.2 million on lobbying. I still don't actually know how accurate that is. But she also says gun rights groups spent, you ready for this? It's got to be well over $100 million, right? Because Greenwald says that, you know, gun lobby's doing stuff that the food industry isn't doing. No, $8.4 million. Gun rights groups spent $8.4 million on lobbying in 2015, according to Francie Deep at Pacific Standard. In other words, less than one-tenth of the money that the food industry has spent lobbying against one particular piece of legislation. I said, this is really one of the worst arguments that I have seen in quite some time. And it really, truly is. The snack industry, the food industry, does spend a lot of money lobbying in support of the people in the industries that it represents. As a matter of fact, the Civil Eats article said that most of that $100 million that had been spent in the first 6 months of 2015, a quarter of it, they say $12.6 million came from just six companies: Coca-Cola, General Mills, Kellogg's, Land O'Lakes, and PepsiCo. Huh. So six companies, Coca-Cola, General Mills, Kellogg's, Land O'Lakes, and PepsiCo, spent more money lobbying against the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act of 2015, for instance, than all lobbying expenditures within the gun industry in 2015. And the NRA, the gun rights organization. And again, this guy's argument is that this isn't happening. That this is, there is something nefarious about, he says it's the gun industry's cynical marketing machine at work. Right? He says the result is a set of laws on the books that most Americans oppose, which makes it not only possible but easy for anyone everywhere, anytime, to get their hands on a deadly weapon. He says the Second Amendment is bizarrely interpreted to mean that the right to bear arms cannot be balanced against the rest of our rights and freedoms, including the right to live safely in our communities. And it's all marketing. He says, marketing is powerful. This is actually pretty important. It says, tell. Marketing is powerful. Marketing backed by millions of dollars has been unstoppable. He says, it's time to connect the dots, untangle the web, recognize the mass manipulation that has been going on for far too long. And it's time to stop it. You know, again, it seems to me that the anti-gun groups and people like Mr. Greenwald here are far more interested in stoking fear about our fellow Americans and our neighbors than the average gun owner. The average gun owner knows, again, that violent crime has been dropping in this country, even as things like concealed carry laws have gone into effect from coast to coast. So if you're an anti-gun advocate, that shouldn't be happening. In fact, if you're an anti-gun advocate, your position is more guns inevitably equals more crime, when in reality, no, actually, we've had more guns in this society. Now, what, over 300 million firearms? And crime is at 40-year lows. So we get back to the fundamental problem with Mr. Greenwald's column here. This unwillingness to acknowledge reality, which is a really bad trait for a documentary filmmaker to have. All right, we've got to take a quick timeout. When we come back, Cheryl Todd of Gun Freedom Radio says, don't be a butt when it comes to gun ownership and self-defense. Stick around. We are just getting started here on this Monday edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.
I'm speaking with Jim Sapieca, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, there's three museums. Let's talk about that third museum you guys have way out west.
That third museum is kind of a little hidden jewel box. It doesn't get the press that the other two bigger museums get, but it's a spectacular little display case. It's the Frank Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and it's at the NRA Whittington Center in Raton, New Mexico. Now, folks who are really shooters will know what the Whittington Center is, but those who may not be that active, it's a spectacular range and hunting complex that is owned and operated by the NRA. There are tens of thousands of acres out there with spectacular ranges where a lot of different championship matches are shot in addition to general recreational and sporting shooting. But they also have the Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and they have some great guns there. Of course, that history of that area is just spectacular, going back to the conquistadors. And they follow the evolution of firearms in that area throughout that multiple century span. They also have firearms that are used in the types of competitions that take place at the Whittington Center. And they recently got a spectacular group of modern engraved firearms. There are masterworks there that I have never seen the likes of before. So if you're in that area, and it's a great area for vacationing, there's a lot of attractions in that area, be sure you don't miss this little jewel box of a museum there.
And how do you get to see all the museums online?
Well, you can. We have several social media platforms. We've got, of course, the website, nramuseums.com. And, of course, we have our Facebook page. You can friend us there and get our Gun of the Day posts. So you can visit us on the Internet, Facebook, get the books. And for sure, come by and see the three museums. They're all open every day of the week, and admission is always free.
Speaking with Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. Dan, welcome to NRA News. Tell us, what is Hire Our Heroes?
Yeah, so Hire Our Heroes is a nonprofit organization that basically helps transitioning veterans to position themselves for employment as they get out of the service.
Why'd you start this, Dan?
I served in the Marine Corps Reserves, and after 8 years, I got out thinking I had this great skill set. I was a satellite communications specialist, and shortly thereafter, long story short, there was really no opportunity for me to really find employment or anybody to help me find employment. So I felt like I was on an island by myself, and I thought if I couldn't be the only veteran going through this, that there was probably a need for a greater reach. And lo and behold, I gathered a few other veterans, and we formed Hire Our Heroes, basically founded by veterans for veterans.
That is great. So what's the reaction been to Hire Our Heroes?
You know, it's been phenomenal. It's one of those things, be careful what you wish for. The response has been overwhelming at times, but it has been nothing short of great and rewarding at the same time. There's nothing but opportunity for us to help veterans. And believe it or not, there's a lot of nonprofits out there, and these veterans still have a tough time really finding the right one that's going to bring them down the path to success as they transition out.
Dan,
we feel like we've got a pretty cool tool set to do that.
Awesome. Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. How can folks get more information about the great work you're doing and your great organization?
Visit us on the web at hireourheroes.org, and they can fill out information on whether or not they're interested in transitioning, reaching for somebody to reach out for them to connect, as well as some of our other services and that we offer.
Dan Caporelli, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. Sean Maloney of Buckeye Firearms Association going to join us a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from the Gun Freedom Radio Show and Arizona Firearms, azfirearms.com. Cheryl Todd is with us. How are you, Cheryl?
I am very well. Thank you so much for having me on the show and for saying AZ Firearms correctly, because I feel like I almost need to have a slogan that says, there is an Arizona Firearms in Arizona, but that ain't us, you know, so.
Absolutely.
Great.
Well, listen,
company.
I know how important it is to get the website right. So
Thank you. Absolutely.
And I got to say, this is a great piece that you wrote a few days ago. Don't be a butt about self-defense.
Yeah.
B-U-T, by the way, right?
Yeah, yeah, a little cheeky, you know, but I really get, I tense up when I hear people say, oh yeah, I'm a gun owner, and then the next word is, but, that tells me that they're not educated, they're not informed. They're like, you know, a fair weather friend that just happened to go wander into a gun shop because it's the latest shiny thing, maybe. And so I thought, well, I'll just kind of wrap some words around it.
So, yeah, and you say instead of but nothing, how about I am a gun owner and, right?
Exactly, because, you know, I kind of spell out there's three different buts. There's kind of the arrogant celebrity elitist that use the word but because they seem to know the best, right? And so the very people on the liberal side that are all about you don't close the door behind you, close the door of opportunity, well, they're doing it with the gun rights. So just like Whoopi said on her program, I'm a gun owner, but nobody needs a semi-auto. She said full auto, but she meant semi-auto. Then there's Mr. Trendy, who is the, you know, it's the new shiny accessory to my life, but I'm only going to go so deep as to learn little bumper sticker pieces of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the Bloomberg groups that are the fake gun owners. All right. And so they're the ones that make it sound like they're one of us. They agree with us, but we just need, you know, the common sense changes to our laws. And so where you were saying we need the and, I'm saying I'm a gun owner and I will protect and defend my rights from being eroded away by politicians and the uninformed. I'm a gun owner and I already know the laws that are on the books. So new laws aren't going to make bad guys any less prone to doing the wrong things. It's just going to give them more laws to break and us more laws to break. You know, the perfectly law-abiding citizen that's now going to trip over these new laws upon laws. You know, mm-hmm. So here's a law to make sure that we enforce a law. It's already been a law.
Well, absolutely. So. And this is something, you know, that I actually wrote about this for my Cam's Corner column, because every day on this program, we have a segment called the Deal of the Day, and it's the plea deal of the day. And that's because 97% of felony cases in this country are plea bargained down, right? Mm. You've got laws on the books. And so there was a case out of not far from where we are in Farmville, Virginia, in Amelia County, where a guy got sentenced to 30 years for rape, Cheryl. He served two. Because,
oh my gosh.
Right? Because the rest of it was a plea bargain down to a suspended sentence. And these stories are common. So, you know, look, I suppose if you're an anti-gun advocate, you would say, well, look, the system works, right? He was arrested, he was tried, he was convicted. The system works. Whereas I think you and I would say, no, this isn't enforcing the laws that are on the books because he got 30 years. And that should mean that he does something close to 30 years. This is a sign that the system doesn't work, that we aren't fully enforcing the existing laws. And if we aren't fully enforcing the existing laws, why in God's green earth would we want to add another law or two or however many umpteen laws they want to add on, especially those that, again, as you point out, are designed to restrict the legal gun ownership of Americans. They don't touch the violent criminals.
Exactly. When we see how often exactly what you pointed out happens, it shows us it's really not about keeping society safer. So we're to say that this man was supposed to serve 30 years and somehow he's completely turned himself around in two. I don't necessarily think that there's anything telling us that that is the truth. So now we've put him back out on the streets and at the same time saying, in order to make the world safer, forget about that guy and what he's probably going to go out and do again. To make the world safer, let's make it more difficult for the average citizen like myself. I'm just a mom. I'm just a grandma. And I happen to believe in my Second Amendment rights, and I happen to want to preserve them for the next generation and the generation after that. And how do I do that? I don't say that by being a butt. I say that by knowing my rights, knowing the laws, impressing upon my local politicians to enforce those laws and to stand for the Second Amendment rights. And I hope that everyone will understand that distinct difference. And it's kind of like when you the FBI is studying to pick out what a counterfeit bill looks like.
Mm-hmm.
They don't study counterfeit bills. They study real bills so that when something fake comes along, they instantly realize there's something amiss here.
So if we know the laws, we're involved in the groups that are helping preserve our laws, like the NRA, the NSSF, your local Citizens Defense League, the Second Amendment Foundation. It goes on and on. If you're involved in those things, then you'll be able to spot those butts the minute they open their mouth, and you'll be able to say, wait a minute, what they're getting ready to say isn't right. Or maybe I need to examine that more closely before I just jump on that bandwagon. And right now is when it's so important, because people are going to be going to the polls and they're going to be putting down on paper their opinions. And if it's an uninformed opinion, elections have consequences. And the next person that holds the president's seat is likely to put in possibly four of our next Supreme Court judges. So it's not just even about who we're electing for president. It's who they're going to bring on board, who they're going to fill their cabinet seats with, and who they're going to place on the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. So, I mean, we say this, you know, every election, because it's kind of true every election, but this is the most important election of our lifetimes. I have no doubt of that. Hey, listen, Cheryl, we've got to run, but I appreciate you coming on the program. Where can folks hear you on Gun Freedom Radio?
We are on 960 The Patriot. That's out of Phoenix. But really, the best way to go is to put that on that app on your smartphone, because then you can listen live nationwide. We're a Saturday show from 1 to 3 p.m. Mountain Time. And you can also go to our website, which is gunfreedomradio.com, and we post all of our podcasts there.
Awesome. Cheryl, thanks so much for coming on the show. Hope we can talk again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Cheryl Todd joining us again from Gun Freedom Radio here on NRA News, Cam & Company. I'll give you a bonus deal of the day, since we were just talking about this with Cheryl. I'm actually surprised that this story made the paper. It must be a slow news day in Chattanooga, Tennessee. WDEF. Must be a slow news day for the TV station. A man with a criminal rap sheet nearly 5 pages long has been arrested for alleged sexual assault. 30-year-old Craig Eberhardt of Chattanooga, Tennessee, charged with one count of sexual battery after the alleged victim told police he came up behind her and stuck his hands far between her legs. Victim told police that she and her brother were walking to their vehicle when a man came up behind her, then stuck his hand far up her dress. Woman also told police that a fight started as a result of the inappropriate touching. During the fight, she was reportedly hit in the mouth. The woman eventually flagged down an officer about a block away and gave the officer a description of the man who assaulted her. She also said that her attacker had run back towards Market Street. Police caught up with the man, matching the description, identified him as Craig Eberhardt. According to the arrest affidavit, Eberhardt admitted to police that he sexually assaulted her. In addition to the sexual battery charge, Eberhardt also charged with public intoxication. Bond set at $9,000. Hamilton County court records show that Eberhardt has a history of multiple arrests and convictions for public intoxication, assault, vandalism, disorderly conduct, criminal trespass, theft, and attempted retaliation against court officials. His nearly 5 pages of criminal convictions date back to 2007. According to sources within the Hamilton County court system, Eberhardt has a record amount of unpaid criminal fines that amount to more than $130,000. Eberhardt is scheduled to appear in court Monday morning. Now, here's a guy. Doesn't appear as if many of his charges rise to the level of serious violent offenses, although attempted retaliation against court officials would like to know a little bit more about that case. Disorderly conduct, vandalism, assault, criminal trespass. The problem is that Mr. Eberhardt gets out of jail and commits another crime. And he gets out of jail and he commits another crime. And doesn't matter that he hasn't paid his fines for the last crime. He's still let out of jail. Bond still set at a pretty low amount. And this is the system working for Mr. Eberhardt. And again, if you feel like, well, the system is great, we just need to have more laws on the books. That's the problem. We just don't have enough laws. We have more laws, then the system will be even better. Then the system is working for you, because again, Mr. Eberhardt has all of these convictions and he's 30 years old. But how does one get to be 30 years old and have basically an 8-year uninterrupted run of breaking the law? How does this happen in a system that works? Or is this how the system is supposed to function? That is, again, as long as you stay off the front page of the paper, as long as you don't lead the nightly news, you can break the law, not with impunity, because again, you may very well get convicted, but you're probably going to be offered a plea to lesser charges. But this can be your life. The revolving door of justice, spending a couple of weeks or a couple of months behind bars, going back out on the streets for a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months, maybe a couple of days, heck, maybe a couple of hours, before you start all over again. I don't think most people would say that the system is working if this is the result of the system. And I certainly don't think when you take a look at the way the system is functioning right now, that a lot of people say, well, the answer is we just don't have enough laws on the books. We just don't have enough people in court for the crime of having a magazine that holds more than 10 rounds. We don't have enough people going to trial for possessing a semi-automatic rifle with two characteristics that anti-gun control advocates or anti-gun advocates don't like. You know, no violent offense, anything like that, just the gun possession charge, the magazine possession charge, maybe loaning a firearm to a friend without a transfer, going through an FFL. We just don't have enough of those cases going to trial or being plea bargained down. That's the problem here. I don't know too many Americans who actually would think that. When confronted with the scope of the problem. The problem is we generally aren't confronted with the scope of the problem. All right, why don't we take a quick timeout? Sean Maloney of Buckeye Farms is going to join us. Talking about it is a compensated confiscation program, but it's one with a twist in Ohio. We'll chat about it again with Sean right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
With the NSSF Project Child Safe. Bill, welcome to NRA News.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Hey, thanks for being here. And what a great program, the Project Child Safe program. I absolutely love it. Tell folks, what is it?
Yeah, for those who aren't familiar with it, this is the firearms industry's safety program. It was launched in 1999 as Project Home Safe initially, and then it evolved into Project Child Safe. And it really operates along two central fronts. One is it's all about firearm safety education, primarily focusing on responsible storage of firearms when they're not in use. And then hand-in-hand with that, the other facet of this, and kind of the centerpiece of the program, is we give away free gun locks to police departments all across the country to hand out in their communities. And so far, we've given away 37 million of those locks.
37 million.
Yeah, it's been a phenomenally successful program, and it is something that the firearms community can be very proud of.
Wow, that's amazing. So how did this program get started and why?
Well, primarily it got started because it was an opportunity for the industry to step up and say, you know, we don't want to see firearms accidents happen. There's, you know, even today, unfortunately, too many stories of children finding loaded guns in the home and an accident resulting from that. And so the industry stepped up. There was a brainstorm of somebody at NSSF to come up with this program to basically let's teach people what they need to know about proper firearm safety and expel some of the myths like, you know, a hidden gun is not a safe gun, for example. And at the same time, let's take away some of the barriers to safe storage by making these locks available for free.
And Bill, you're with the National Shooting Sports Foundation. People don't know that the NSSF is the industry, the shooting industry's association.
That's a trade association.
Yeah, trade association. Industry, huh? So you have done this, you know, working in concert with the, you know, all the different gun manufacturers. But NSSF has really taken a leadership role as this program has grown. Tell us over the years, how has it grown and changed?
Sure. Well, we were very, very big program in the 2000s. We were getting a lot of federal funding through the Department of Justice to do the program, and that's where we had a lot of our biggest successes, and where we, you know, were giving away most of the locks. Then in 2008, the grant terms expired and they weren't renewed, and so the NSSF on its own continued to fund the program for the next several years. And I am happy to say that for 2016, some of that federal funding has now been renewed.
Oh, good.
To the tune of about $2 million, which, you know, as we say, every $2 puts another lock in someone's hands. And so that will provide a lot of money for both making more locks available in communities as well as getting more educational resources out there.
And Bill, one of the things we all talk about is, as you mentioned, is safety is paramount. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you're at home, you're on the range, that's like, the first order of business when it comes to, the firearm, using a firearm, whether you're hunting or shooting or at the range or whatever. So in some of the time we left, what are some of the most egregious kind of safety violations you guys are aware of?
Well, it's the funny thing. It's like when you look at the rules of firearm safety, number one, they're not rocket science. And number two, they really haven't changed since the firearm was invented. It's pointed in a safe direction, keep it stored safely, things like that. And my personal opinion is I think that's why we have some of the accidents we do, is because the rules have been out there so long and they're so simple that we get a little bit complacent.
Yeah, and maybe take them for granted, right?
Exactly.
Which, when it comes to a firearm, you never want to take it for granted. So
that's right.
It's Bill Romanelli. It's the NSSF Project Child Safe. I love it. Bill, how can people get more information about Project Child Safe, about the National Shooting Sports Foundation? What do they need to do?
Sure. The easiest thing, of course, is going to go onto our website, which is www.projectchildsafe.org. We really would love people to, as individuals, sign up as supporters of the program. Also for organizations out there, retailers, shooting ranges, people in the conservation community. We want as much help as we can get getting this word out. We don't rely on ourselves alone. We want to basically have essentially a team of messengers out there helping us get this message out there to the firearms-owning community. And if I may, it's something that I've noticed is that the firearms-owning community, the firearm community as a whole, they're a very proud community. They do not like being villainized or demonized.
Right.
And they focus on ethical hunting. They focus on responsible gun ownership. They're looking for something to be for and something that they can rally around. And this is a program that they can do that with.
That's awesome. All right, Bill, we got about 20, 30 seconds left. Once again, how can we get more information about Project Child Safe?
Sure. Go to www.projectchildsafe.org. If you're looking for safety resources, just click on our safety tab. Cool. Our entire library of safety resources is available there.
Beautiful. Bill Romanelli, the NSSF Project Child Safe, thanks for what you do. Thanks for the National Shooting Sports Foundation for what they do. And thanks for being on NRA News.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Coming up next hour, Michael Barone, the Dean of American Politics, joining us. Your guide to the Republican primaries. Michael has put it out there. Also, Bob Owens of Bearing Arms. Right now, I want to welcome to the program our friend Sean Maloney from Buckeye Farms Association. Sean, how are you, sir?
I'm doing really good, Cam. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program today. I saw the story in the Cincinnati Inquirer, and I was intrigued by this because we've covered a lot of gun buybacks. I like to call them compensated confiscation programs over the years. This one, a little bit of a twist, though, Sean, because the firearms that are turned in, they're not melted down. They're not turned into lutes or sitars or anything like that. They're actually sold to federal firearms licensees, and then they find a good home somewhere, right?
Yeah, actually about 2 months ago, I was going into a meeting a Butler County sheriff had. He has a kind of an annual, it's not really a fundraiser. He just thanks all the supporters and everybody that's made Butler County and the area a safer place. And I was approached by Charles Tassel, who's a council member for long in the Deer Park area, actually. And he started talking to me about an idea he had and about community guns. And we had a discussion about community guns, which are guns that are hidden and sometimes in plain view, where all the bad guys allegedly know where these guns are if they need one. And, of course, we can discuss whether those actually exist. I'm sure they do, but not to the extent that people say they do. And he said, if we can get these firearms off the street, I'm not anti-gun. I don't want to destroy them. Let's turn them in. If they can be sold, if they haven't been used in a crime, if they have serial numbers on them, then let's just turn them back into an FFL. Let's sell the guns, and then in case my program's on. And I just thought that was a great idea. And I think probably he just doesn't want to have an annualized gun buyback program. When I was talking to him, I think he just wants the community to know, hey, if you find a gun, if you know where a bad guy keeps his gun, just turn it in and try to be safer.
And so the if there's a serial number, it is checked to see if it has been reported lost or stolen, and then the firearms returned to its rightful owner. If there is no serial number, it's turned over to the police, and then otherwise, again, an FFL gets a chance to purchase the gun and then sell it at retail.
Oh, absolutely. And it's good because if you think about it, you know, we know that the majority of these, or the vast majority of these firearms that are turned in, a lot of times someone has one in their house. The husband's no longer there. It's a piece of World War II history or memorabilia. And so the mother or whoever's left in the house turns it in. It preserves some historical firearms and also, yes, we all know that it's, the gun's not the bad thing, and you don't change criminal behavior from the absence of one. So it lets the gun live another day and gives somebody the opportunity who maybe couldn't afford a nice gun to afford one now. So, you know, it has several pluses.
You know, it's interesting. As I said, Sean, we've covered a lot of these buybacks or compensated confiscation programs over the years. Never have I seen a news story question whether or not a program like this requires a federal firearms license. Never. As long as, again, the stated intent is, well, we're going to destroy these firearms, that you know, whatever, we won't ask any tough questions. But the Inquirer did think this was interesting enough to ask, you know, is something wrong here? Are they breaking the law in any way? And the answer is no, they're not.
No, absolutely not. And I was smiling when you were saying that because I didn't realize that. You're right. The Inquirer takes something that's been a good thing to them in the past, but now because they're not going to immediately destroy these same firearms that are obtained the same way, they're going to try to legally put them back in the stream of commerce. Now we got to make sure that they don't need an FFL to do it. So that's a good point. And, you know, it's unfortunately, if you're from the Cincinnati area, the Cincinnati Inquirer has kind of taken a turn. They used to be very objective, and they've kind of lost some of that. I think there's been some changes in the newspaper. But that's a good point. Those aren't questioned when you're turning them in and destroying them, but as soon as you want to do some good, you know, we better take a look at this.
Right. There you go, Sean. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is always a pleasure getting a chance to talk with you. And I know as we gear up here, the caucus is today, and now we're going to be in the real thick of the primary season. I know we'll be talking about the efforts of grassroots NRA members and what we can do to make our voices heard this election.
I'm sure we'll be talking about that, and the NRA has their campaign field reps already in place, and so they're working on it as we speak. It's great talking to you, Cam.
Good talking with you too, Sean. Thanks so much. Sean Maloney joins us from Buckeye Firearms Association, member of the NRA's Board of Directors as well, former NRA ILA Volunteer of the Year winner as well. I mentioned Michael Barone is going to join us on the program coming up next hour with your guide to the Republican primaries, the caucuses again underway in Iowa, and then we have New Hampshire closely following, again, about a month from today, not about a month, a month from today. We will see Virginia and its primary, and it looks like the headline I saw from the Times-Dispatch a couple days ago was that the Virginia GOP was going to drop its requirement that you would vote for the Republican candidate in the fall election. That was part of their considerations as to who was going to be able to vote in the open primary. Meanwhile, the Bloomberg boomlet, if you even want to call it that, appears to be deflating a little bit. The New York Times reporting over the weekend, a Bloomberg-sponsored poll made public in extravagant Bloomberg style amid shrimp and champagne. Delivered some sour notes about Michael Bloomberg himself. Few Iowa voters like him as he weighs a third-party White House run. A poll of likely caucus goers conducted for Bloomberg Politics in the Des Moines Register and released on Saturday night found that just 17% of Democrats and just 9% of Republicans had a, quote, favorable view of Michael Bloomberg. No word on independence. Among likely Republican caucus goers in Iowa, half had an unfavorable view of Mr. Bloomberg. 26% of the Democrats had an overall unfavorable view of him. By comparison, 50% of the Republicans polled had a favorable view of another Manhattan billionaire, Donald J. Trump. 46% of the Democrats had a favorable view of Martin O'Malley. The New York Times says the poll in related to Mr. Bloomberg was contained in a news release handed out to reporters, but the pollster on hand and the staff from Bloomberg Politics did not seem eager to highlight it. I wonder why. The data was discussed in the prodding of Ben Smith, editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, who asked about it during an event for the news media held inside a TV studio custom-built for Bloomberg Politics inside the Marriott Hotel. And then they said, a lot of people don't have any opinion of him, so he's got a high ceiling. 9% of Republicans, 17% of Democrats. Now, again, these are likely caucus goers in Iowa. So I suppose if you're Michael Bloomberg and you're still looking for that poll that says, yes, America is clamoring to be turned into Bloombergia, then maybe, you know, you want to look at a poll somewhere other than Iowa. Maybe you want to look like, I don't know, Upper West Side of Manhattan? Beverly Hills? I mean, you probably don't even want to pull, like, all of L.A. or all of New York. But I'm sure you picked your spots carefully. Michael Bloomberg could craft that poll, or his pollster could craft that poll showing that America is, in fact, fired up. As a matter of fact, GeekWire.com. Well, no, never mind. They say he's Tech's favorite potential presidential candidate. They also say he scores low in Iowa poll by his own news service. GeekWire says Bloomberg did receive some good news last week. Chuck Hagel said that he would back Michael Bloomberg if he ran. Oh, well, put some more shrimp on the Barbie and pop the cork in another bottle of champagne, I suppose, right? Yeah. I just don't see it. But it is a weird election year, and, you know, anything can happen. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton is asking Iowa caucus goers to make gun control a, quote, voting issue at their caucuses. And she should probably specify, like, no, I mean in support of gun control. The Washington Post says, speaking in a cavernous atrium at an Iowa State University engineering hall to a crowd of nearly 1,200, the former Secretary of State's voice rose in anger as she stressed the importance of the need to curb gun violence. She said, quote, what is wrong with us? How can we continue to ignore the toll that this is taking on our children and our country? You know, again, until the first 6 months of 2015, violent crime had been dropping in this country for quite some time. And hopefully that was a statistical blip, and we see this 20-year drop in crime continue through all of last year and on into this year. So, first of all, we're not doing nothing. Crime is actually at 40-year low in this country. That's doing something. And again, if the candidate is unwilling to acknowledge the reality of what's actually occurring in this country, maybe she's not aware of it. Wonder if Sidney Blumenthal sent her an email or anything ever about it. She said, none of this will stick. She said, none of it will stick if it's not a voting issue. As you go to caucus Monday night, please think about this. Post says, Clinton studiously avoided any mention of her opponent Bernie Sanders' positions on gun legislation. That's because the difference between the two are wafer thin at best. I mean, especially now that Bernie Sanders is out there co-sponsoring a repeal of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. Post says her position on gun control is a regular part of her stump speech here. But when contrasting her positions with Sanders, she focuses on their policy disagreements on health care and college affordability. You know what's actually fascinating is Hillary Clinton's in Iowa stumping for this, right? She was asked, or detailed the reasons why people should own a gun or could own a gun. What was it? Hunting, sport shooting, and collecting, right? In Iowa, she said this. Barack Obama at that CNN town hall style event not long ago, He talked about when he was campaigning in Iowa in 2008, and he said that Michelle Obama turned to him and said, you know, because they were driving out in the boonies, and she said, you know, I can understand why people would want to own a gun for self-defense out here, right, because it's a right of rural Americans, but not suburban or urban Americans to keep and bear arms. Even Barack Obama, in this anecdote, and that's not the first time that he's told that anecdote, by the way, but that's the anecdote that he tells to try to show that, hey, I'm okay with the Second Amendment. I mean, if you live out in the middle of nowhere, sure, you could own a bolt-action rifle. But even he said, well, you know, out here in Iowa, yeah, sure, you could own a gun of some sort for self-defense. Hillary Clinton's not even willing to go that far, which is telling. The Washington Post says that going into the weekend, Clinton got a last-minute boost by cinching the endorsement of the New York Times editorial board on Saturday morning. I think that matters much for Iowans, you think? I'm thinking probably not. Probably care as much about the opinion of the New York Times editorial board as they care about the anti-gun opinion of Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, for that matter, or Bernie Sanders, or Martin O'Malley. All right, stick around. Hour 2 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nozzle, is coming up right after this.
Speaking with Kevin Neuendorf with USA Shooting. Kevin, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm doing wonderful. It's an Olympic year, so a lot of excitement building.
Man, oh, man, there's a lot of excitement. So a lot of things to talk about. We want to talk about Rio, of course. We're going to get to that. But first, you have a new campaign that you guys just launched. Tell me about it.
Well, it's the Shooting is My Olympic Sport campaign. So one of the things that we're trying to do is rally a community around the aspect of Olympic shooting. So not many people know that, you know, there's 15 Olympic disciplines, shooting events. And so what we're trying to do is gather everybody around this vast community that we have and really get them to rally around our Olympic shooting sports. So, you know, not many people may follow the Olympics. They, you know, they may know of gymnastics or track and field,
right, yeah,
but we're going to bring them to shooting. You know, we could all rally around that. So that's kind of what we're doing this year.
Awesome.
Going to have a lot of fun around it. So we developed this nice new logo. And just trying to bring everybody together around our cause.
I love it. So tell us about Rio. How's it looking?
Hey, we're looking good. We've got several world champions. Of course, we've got the return of, you know, Kim Rohde, a five-time Olympic medalist.
Great Kim Rohde. What a great ambassador for the shooting sport she is.
Yeah, she's
an ambassadress. I don't know. Yeah. Whatever the right word. She's awesome.
Yeah, whatever she is, she does it really well, so including shooting. So, you know, so she's got to make her spot still. That's how competitive our events are. Oftentimes, the hardest thing to do in the United States is make our own team.
Right. It's qualify, right?
Qualify.
Yeah.
Because there's that much depth. You know, Kim competes in skeet shooting. Well, we have a world champion in Morgan Kraft who's already earned her spot to Rio. So she beat out Kim.
Uh-oh, here we go.
So there's two spots, and Kim's in the lead right now, and we'll find out in May if she makes the team, but she's looking pretty good right now.
I'll tell you what, Kevin, backstep a little bit with me here, talking about Rio then. What are, because, you know, this is where sometimes it gets confusing even for me, what are the current the shooting events that are going to be in the Olympics?
Yeah, if you think it's confusing for the, you know, what do you think I am? So I'm trying to explain it all. We got 15 Olympic events. We got five events in pistol, five events in shotgun, and five events in rifle.
So how does the U.S. Olympic Committee determine that, or how's it? Because didn't one of the events that Kim was in a few years ago got changed or worked in? I know they changed the sports a lot.
Yeah, so the International Olympic Committee really kind of sets the table in terms of what Olympic events are in, and they're always looking at refactoring in a whole bunch of different things, whether it be gender equity or how well they play off on television or whatever it is. So they're always adding and subtracting events. So it's determined by the International Olympic Committee, and then they work with the International Federation for Shooting.
So now listen to that, folks. 15 shooting events in the Olympics. So shooting is not only my Olympic sport, but the Olympic sport. It's a big part of the Olympics. So it's it's important we all get to know about it.
Yeah, there's a couple facts there that are important. USA Shooting has won 107 Olympic medals all time. We've been in every Olympics since 1896.
Wow.
A lot of people wouldn't understand the success that we've had, but we're fourth most among all medals. So if you think of the big events, track and field, swimming, gymnastics,
right,
the things that we traditionally dominate in, we're fourth best among all sports in winning
That's
medals.
Awesome.
So we've got a great history of success.
We're there to take that ride with you guys here at NRA News. We love the stuff we do with you. Before we run out of time, Kevin, how can people get more information about USA Shooting, about this new campaign?
We got to go to the website, usashooting.org. You can also find us on social media at USA Shooting. Let's rally around this idea of shooting is my Olympic sport.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Bob Owens of Bearing Arms joining us on the program a little bit later on in the hour. Also, Michael Barone from the Washington Examiner. He's out with his guide to Republican primaries. Also at the Examiner, just saw this story, an 11-point intensity gap. Favors Republicans. Paul Bedard publishing this earlier today. He says a new poll by Ed Goes shows that Republicans are more eager to vote. This was for the Centrist Republican Ripon Society. An 11-point intensity gap among white Republicans and white Democrats. He said Ed Goes did in 2010. They measured a 9-point advantage on intensity. In 2014, a 7-point advantage on intensity, meaning our voters are more intense about voting. Right now, we have an 11-point advantage, he said. I've never seen a double-digit advantage in terms of intensity to vote. Huh. I wonder if Hillary Clinton, stumping as the gun control candidate, will drive up the intensity of her likely voters. Or will it perhaps decrease the intensity of those excited about voting for a candidate like Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders? Again, given that polling shows about a third of self-identified Democrats and about a quarter of self-identified liberals are Second Amendment supporters. They think it is more important to protect the right to keep and bear arms than it is to pass another gun control law. She's hoping. She really is. But it doesn't seem likely to me. This article by the Washington Post, by the way, talking about Hillary Clinton making the case for gun control. Not really. Just making the case that gun control should be an issue that people vote on. Has some of the worst. It's just a little aside. Abby Phillip ends her piece. You know, got to end on a light note here. As Clinton and Sanders barrel towards the finish line in Iowa, they're each seeking an edge by drumming up enthusiasm among their base of supporters. Clinton advisor James Carville admonished Clinton supporters with his characteristic Cajun flair in a fundraising email this morning. This is crunch time now. I won't do the accent. This election is tighter than an alligator wearing a tutu. That's not characteristic Cajun flair, I don't think. Not like I lived in Louisiana, but I have friends from Louisiana. I've visited there before. I've never heard anybody use that phrase, tighter than an alligator in a tutu. I'm not even sure what that would mean. I mean, alligators can be pretty small and tutus can run pretty large, so I just think James Carville is, like, making stuff up now. And as long as it has, like, some sort of reference to Louisiana, apparently that's all that's necessary for the Washington media to say, oh, it must be a characteristic Cajun flair of James Carville's coming through. That's like just – so, Cameron, if you're from Texas, could you just use the phrase alligator wearing a – or armadillo wearing a tutu? And would that just automatically be, like, characteristic Texas flair?
Yeah, it's like a Chinese menu. You pick your state. Pick your animal. Well, like a Mad Lib, really. Fill in the state. Pick an animal. Pick an adjective.
That's just lame. I mean, that's just it just seems like mailing it in from James Carville. He used to get back to Louisiana. I'm pretty sure they're not talking about alligators wearing tutus, but Who knows? Maybe that's it. Maybe he does have his finger on the pulse of Louisiana slang, but I kind of doubt it. All right, we are taking a look at some of the other Second Amendment news and information out there. I know that it is caucus day in Iowa, but we also have legislation that is introduced and making its way through state capitals around the country. In Oregon, the Oregonian's Dennis Thirault reporting that Oregon Democrats are lining up behind a couple of anti-gun bills. House Bill 4147 from House Majority Leader Jennifer Williamson would clarify that gun purchasers whose background checks take longer than 72 hours won't be able to buy weapons by default. Instead, they would have to wait as long as it took for the Oregon State Police to complete the check. Oregonian says the measure would affect just a fraction of gun purchases in Oregon. Then there is Senate Bill 1551, which would, according to the Oregonian, ban the sale of a firearm for 30 days if someone tips off authorities that the would-be buyer appears to be in a mental health crisis. So somebody could just make an anonymous call and say, hey, you know, I think Bob's having a breakdown right now. And Bob can't purchase a firearm for 30 days? Senator Floyd Prezansky, a Democrat from Eugene, heads the Senate Judiciary Committee. That's where the bill is originating. Senate Majority Leader Jenny Burdick of Portland said that she would be, quote, most surprised if the bill passed this year. They might try to hold it off until next year. Why? Just out of curiosity. Burdick, the Oregonian, says has floated similar legislation for 2017 that would allow police to remove guns from someone in a crisis. So, I'm trying to follow the logic here. All right, so we've got this bill that says somebody can call police anonymously, say Bob's having a breakdown, and Bob can't buy a gun for 30 days. This supposed to be a life-saving measure, right? Desperately needed. Who knows how many people are put at risk by the fact that this law is not already on the books. If you're an advocate for this legislation, that's your argument. But we're going to wait till 2017 to push this, probably. And if the Senate Majority Leader is saying, well, I'd be surprised if it passed, you know, she's probably the one in charge of scheduling these bills, right? So why would they, if, again, they really thought this was a valuable life-saving measure, why would they wait a year to try to run the bill? Oh, because this year is an election year. I see. And the universal background check bill, quote unquote, that was passed last year in Oregon has not gone over well throughout much of the state. Remember, you have a number of law enforcement, a number of county sheriffs saying that they don't know how to enforce this. You have some saying that they will not enforce this. So you probably want to stay away from a big sweeping gun control bill or a bill that would deprive people of their civil rights without due process based on an anonymous phone call. You probably want to avoid doing that in an election year. Unless you really think that this is an important piece of legislation that is going to save lives, in which case, election year be damned, you put this before the voters and you put it before the state senators, you cast your vote and you take your lumps and you maybe try to explain your position to the voters who may not be inclined to go along with this. But it doesn't sound like that's what they're trying to do. It sounds like they're trying to push this off until it's not an election year. Which, again, to me, says a lot about the actual public safety benefit of legislation like this. Oregonian says in a session with reporters on Tuesday, House Minority Leader Mike McClain, Republican from Powell Butte, reminded reporters that some Democrats, such as Burdick, had said earlier that they were not planning substantial gun bills for 2016. He said now they're starting to pop up all over the place. Huh. Interesting. Well, we will, again, keep our eyes on what's going on in Oregon. Sounds like there might be some behind-the-scenes wrangling among anti-gun advocates there in the state legislature as to how much they want to push during an election year. Meanwhile, in Delaware, state news reporting that more Delawareans are concealed carry holders these days. As a matter of fact, concealed carry licenses jumped 56% in the state of Delaware from 2014 to 2015. That's pretty amazing. They say that there were 1,674 permit applications in 2014. There were 2,614 permit applications in 2015. And what's most interesting about this is every month in 2015 in Delaware, the number of applications actually increased. In other words, there were more in February than in January. There were more in March than in February, more in April, right? In December of last year, the state of Delaware received 348 concealed carry applications, which was more than double the 155 applications from December of 2014. That is really, really interesting. Delaware State News talked with Brian Brown, who owns Smyrna Sporting Goods. He says that there has been a huge influx of people looking for firearms to purchase them that would suit them for protection. He said, it seems like years ago, you had to have a specific reason to want to conceal a firearm, like you were working late and in a dark place or carrying money from a business. Now, he says, it seems like people are getting them for basic personal protection. Well, that's good. It's really good. Don St. John, who teaches a basic pistol course, and the Delaware State News points out, also carries a legally concealed firearm. Pointed out a recent case in Hartley, Delaware. Two people killed in a carjacking. He says a threat still exists in western Kent County where he lives. So a lot of, again, across the state of Delaware, there are a lot more Delawareans who are choosing, again, to exercise their right to keep and bear arms. This is hand in hand with what we are seeing across the rest of the country. And again, there is no stereotypical new concealed carry holder. The firearms instructor, Mr. St. John, says that he's trained ministers and their wives to carry. He says that this is the owner of the sporting goods store, the Smyrna Sporting Goods. He says that most gun purchases for concealment, he says, are made by those in their 40s or older. He says, and there aren't a lot of older people. He said folks in rural homes feel vulnerable, and home invasions, mainly these kids breaking in to steal something. And to meet the demand for the concealed carry application increase, the Delaware Department of Justice has two investigators that are tasked with simply working on the applications. Four other staffers are involved part-time. And the again, the number of citizens in the state of Delaware who want to be able to protect themselves, whether they work late or not, going up. A very good thing. This, you know, there are, the estimates are somewhere between, 11 and 13 million Americans who are concealed carry holders. And I would expect that number to, again, continue going up in 2016. Just taking a look here at the violent crime rate in Delaware, what's happened over the last couple of years. Huh, it's gone down. Interesting. 2009, 645 violent crimes per 100,000 people. Now in 2014, down to 489.1. It's a good thing. And again, more people protecting themselves, more legal gun owners, more legal concealed carry holders, and less violent crime. Weird how that works out, isn't it? All right, when we come back after a quick timeout, Mr. Michael Barone is going to join us of the Washington Examiner. Now that the Iowa caucuses are underway, well, for those of you, again, on SiriusXM Patriot, are done and gone in the rearview mirror, and we're looking ahead to New Hampshire. We are in the thick of the presidential primary season, and Michael Barone has his guide to the Republican primaries. Stick around. We'll be right back with much more NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Ruth Ann Sprague with NRA Foundation. Ruth Ann, tell folks, what is NRA Foundation? What do you guys do?
Well, the NRA Foundation is the 501c3 arm of the NRA. So we are there for charitable donations. We're involved in educational pursuits. But we are the part of the NRA. We can go out and raise money as a nonprofit, and a lot of that is done through friends of NRA, and then we can support the shooting sports or historical firearms, museums, things like that.
So you're here to support shooting sports and firearms museums and other things like that. And give us an idea of some of the groups that NRA Foundation supports.
Well, we support the NRA National Firearms Museum, but Boy Scout troops, a lot of youth groups, about 60% of our funding does go towards youth groups. We have supported historical firearms enactors, range improvements for nonprofit ranges, but those are the things that we can support.
So it's NRA Foundation. You raise your money a lot. You said friends of NRA and other ways. And then how can folks who are listening to this go, gosh, how can I get some of this money? What's the best way for them to get involved to find out? How do you guys disperse this?
Well, the best thing to do is to look at our website, nrafoundation.org, and the general public can see how they can contribute. Qualified groups can see how they can apply for a grant. There's a lot of great information at that website.
Great. And in about 20 seconds we have left, why is it important that NRA do this kind of work?
Well, hey, this is the shooting sports. This is the future. What we're doing is raising money now and then giving it to, especially to youth programs. So our youth can learn firearm safety. They can learn about hunters education. And we can carry the hunting tradition and shooting sports into the future.
Speaking with Mike Christensen with Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike, welcome back to NRA News. You've got something neat going on for the new year, the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. What is it all about?
John, this is one of our big fundraisers for the year. Beginning the first Wednesday in March, we're going to give away a gun every week for 52 weeks. At the end of those 52 weeks, everybody who didn't win a gun will go into a drawing. And then we also take all of the winners and put them in a drawing, so somebody is guaranteed to win two guns out of this drawing.
Two guns. That sounds like a good deal. So this is for Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Let's tell folks what it is that you guys do.
John, we're working to give kids who don't have a chance to get outdoors that opportunity. We're taking kids who are served by organizations like Big Brothers and Big Sisters and other youth mentoring organizations, an opportunity to get out, learn to hunt and fish and shoot, and enjoy the great outdoors that we all know and love.
That is so awesome. So how do folks get involved in this drawing?
They can go to outdoormentors.org and click on the Gun a Week drawing link on the front page and get signed up right there.
That is so good. Before we run out of time, once again, it's a 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets are available now. Start drawing first Wednesday in March. And Mike, I got about 30 seconds left. Tell folks why it's so important to get involved with an organization like yours. Why do you do what you do?
There are too many kids today who are never going to have a chance to go hunting and fishing unless those of us who love the outdoors step up and make that happen. And that's what outdoor mentoring is all about.
All right. Once again, it's the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets available now. How do folks get those tickets again, Mike?
Outdoormentors.org. Click on the link right there on the front page.
All right, so you're starting the drawing first Wednesday in March. Go there now and get information and find out more information about this great group, Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike Christensen, thank you, sir, for what you do, and thank you for being on NRA News. You have a good one.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, Bob Owens from Bearing Arms, joining us in just a little bit. Coming up, top of hour three, we have our Hero of the Day, sponsored by AgCorps Defense, our Deal of the Day, our Good Guy of the Day, and more. And right now, I want to welcome to the program from the Washington Examiner, Mr. Michael Barone, joining us. Michael, how are you, sir?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program today. And your guide to the Republican primaries, this is some really fascinating stuff. I mean, I'm a history geek, Michael, and so I love reading about elections in this country because, as you point out, the nominating process has changed quite a bit. I mean, the Constitution itself doesn't mention anything about presidential primaries or how we actually pick our candidates, right?
Well, I think such evidence as I'm familiar with suggests that the framers of the Constitution would have been pretty appalled by our primary process, election presidential nominating process. They didn't like political parties. They thought political parties would be a bad thing. So they had some different ideas about how our system was developed. But it's interesting that in our whole political system, the Constitution is the framework for the federal government, the three branches of government, the founders, the framers set forth certain things. They set forth a pattern for state governments. It says state government should have a Republican form of government, not a Republican party, but a small R Republican form of government, which means, you know, you're not going to have a dictatorship in a state. In 1787, it wasn't at all clear that that wouldn't happen, or that we wouldn't have a king. But they didn't set any parameters for this. So starting with the 72 cycle, we've had most of the national convention delegates have been chosen by primary elections rather than by internal party processes, caucuses and conventions and so forth. But the process, the facts and details have changed every four years. And so in the Washington Examiner, we thought we'd put forth a guide to how the primary process is working out in that complicated race for the Republican nomination.
All right, so let's talk about the Iowa caucuses, if we can, for a second, because there are a lot of folks who, if you're not from Iowa, you may have no idea how these caucuses even work. This isn't a simple matter of walking into a polling place, casting your vote, and walking out, right?
Well, it's a little more difficult than that. Iowa is basically adapted a process that political parties in many states had, but Iowa took advantage of the fact that its election of delegates to county conventions, which is technically what the caucuses are. It was held very early in the year, and they made that a presidential proxy contest with a former governor of Georgia named Jimmy Carter coming in. Everybody knew he had no chance, and of course, the next thing you knew, a year later, he's president of the United States. So that's, you know, the genesis of the Iowa caucus. Starts in at 7 o'clock tonight. That's about when the storm's supposed to kick in over Pottawatomie County and Woodbury County and western Iowa, out of the 99 counties there. In the Republican caucus, you go and cast a secret ballot for your candidate for president. You also may elect delegates to the state convention or the county convention and work on a few resolutions. The Democratic primary is more complicated than that. In the Democratic primary, you announce openly which candidates you're backing. If no candidate has the backing, or if a candidate does not have the backing of 15% of the people in the room, and this is in 1,681 locations throughout the 99 counties of Iowa, if they don't meet that 15% threshold, that candidate doesn't get any votes in that room, and then the people that were for that candidate can change their votes to another candidate. Often they get lobbied, and you have alliances for and against particular candidates. It can get kind of wild and woolly in these Democratic caucuses. And ultimately, the Democrats score who wins the Democratic primary, not on the basis of how many people come and support that person, but what the state convention delegate equivalents are. And if you have a quarter hour, I will give you a description of state convention delegate equivalents, but perhaps your listeners have more important things to do.
We could probably skip that part. The next caucus state, as I'm reading your guide to the Republican primaries, comes February 23rd, the Nevada caucuses, right?
Yes, and basically, particularly on the Republican side, we have no idea who's going to show up to the Nevada caucuses. The Democrats have Nevada caucuses, I believe, on a different day, and some of the labor unions, particularly the Culinary Union, which has a lot of members who work at the Las Vegas casinos, has been an important part of Democratic process in the past. Las Vegas, Metro Las Vegas, Clark County, that's 70% of the population of the whole state. On the Republican side, we don't really know. In the 2008 and 2010 Republican primary caucuses there, you had fewer than 10,000 people taking part. On each occasion, about 50% of the people that showed up were members of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, usually known as the Mormon Church. They cast an overwhelming percentage of their votes for Mitt Romney, who is also a member of the LDS Church. And, well, we don't have any LDS church member candidates running this year. We have no idea who's going to show up to these Republican caucuses.
You know, and this is sort of a theme that you return to in this column, Michael, that you can't necessarily depend on what the political rules have demonstrated, right? I mean, you say that this is even the just the seventh election here, primary election, where you don't have a incumbent candidate for Republicans, so that you say the old rules may not apply. Is that part of the fun of covering an election year, seeing how the electorate has changed?
It's part of the fun. It's part of the, you know, the complex that human beings are complex, that when you think you know all the answers about how they will act, how they will respond, how they will decide, it turns out that, hey, there are other things at stake, and they're not going to necessarily follow your script. So, as you point out, we've only had seven contests in that period, starting in 1972, and most delegates are chosen by primaries. Only seven such contests, and, you know, if you're a social scientist, you want to have 50 examples before you draw a statistically valid conclusion. Well, we're dealing with a sample of seven, which is very much short of 50. And you and I are not going to be around when the 50 number is reached, if it ever is reached. So, you know, the rules are the rules until they're not the rules anymore. And Donald Trump has already given us some tutoring in the proposition that the rules can sometimes be changed.
All right. Now, I don't want to shortchange New Hampshire and South Carolina, the first two primary states here. But I am curious, a month from today, you've got a number of caucuses, right? Or a number of primaries, excuse me, Alabama, Alaska, yeah. Arkansas, Georgia, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, Virginia, and Wyoming will all be voting a month from today. Is it your opinion? Do you think that that will, when you've got such a large chunk of states voting, will that determine the nominee, or are we right now sort of in an election year where even the last state to hold its primary may play a role?
You know, to some extent the answer on that depends on how people vote, but it's very unlikely, it's impossible that any candidate coming out of the March 1st primaries will have accumulated an entitlement to the 1,237 delegates necessary to be nominated to the Republican National Convention, because that many delegates will not yet have been chosen.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have, and in all the contests under the new Republican National Committee rules for this election cycle, there's no winner-take-all primaries until March 15th. At which point Ohio and Florida, the eighth and third largest states, will be voting on a winner-take-all basis. What that means is that when you divide the delegates according proportionally to the number of votes they've received, either statewide or within congressional district, nobody comes out very far ahead. I mean, Iowa's got 30 delegates New Hampshire, I think slightly less. So you're looking at 23 or something of that order. If you're starting to divide 30 delegates proportionally among the vote for 11 candidates, nobody's going to come out of there with more than, you know, a 10-vote lead over another candidate. That leaves them a long way short of 1,237. So, you know, it's possible this nomination fight will go up to the last of the primaries on June 7th or beyond that, that no candidate may have the 1,237 votes after all the primaries and caucuses have been held. But I think in that case, people are not going to wait until the convention assembles in mid-July in Cleveland. They're going to negotiate with the existing delegates and try and get the votes out there. In the old days, you waited till you got to the convention city because people didn't do business by long-distance telephone. They didn't jet travel around the country the way they do, and none of the media had an accurate delegate count. Those days are gone, and to replicate the conditions of the old conventions, you would have to ban long-distance telephone calls, ban jet travel, and close down the Internet. Those things are not going to happen this year.
All right, Michael Barone, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is always a pleasure talking with you, and hope we can do this again throughout the election season.
Excellent. Okay, good luck to you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Michael Barone joining us, and you can read his entire guide to the Republican primaries at the WashingtonExaminer.com. You know, and it is fascinating, given the fact that, as Michael said, none of the states that hold their primaries before March 15th are winner-take-all races, right? Yes, we're all, I mean, it's the first in the nation caucus. I understand a lot of attention being paid there. And New Hampshire is the first in the nation primary. But, you know, again, when you consider the actual number of delegates, that are at stake, it is kind of amazing that we still have the, not just the media attention. The media attention obviously follows the candidate attention. We still have so much candidate attention, on those early states because again, it's about the message. That is sent coming out of Iowa and New Hampshire. Did you overperform? Did you underperform? With the number of delegates at stake, you know, relatively low, elections aren't won or lost at that point. Candidacies aren't won or lost at that point based on the actual results as much as it is the narrative surrounding the campaign. Are you, again, defying expectations? Are you failing to live up to expectations? Did you come out of nowhere or did you crater? Again, a lot of attention being paid for these one states, but the good news is, it sounds like Michael believes that every one of these states, no matter where you live, has the potential to have an impact. I know that sometimes, you know, you live in one of these states where you're one of the last primaries in the nation. You feel like, well, there's no point. You know, the election's already been won or it's already been sewn up. That might not be the case on either side, frankly, for the Republicans or the Democrats this year. And speaking of the Democrats, over at the Observer, Observer.com, John Schindler has a story on Hillary Clinton's emails. He says, last Friday afternoon, the State Department's latest court-mandated release of Hillary Clinton's emails from when she was Secretary of State caused a new political firestorm. Talked about this on Friday's program. Some 22 emails were withheld entirely, and they requested the intelligence community because they said that this was nothing in these emails. You couldn't even release just the blank redacted form. Couldn't do this. The communications within that those emails were too sensitive. And Hillary Clinton's response was, this is just the overclassification of materials. We should release these materials. I mean, that's what her surrogates were saying. That's what she was saying. Go ahead and release these things. Well, John Schindler, who is a former intelligence analyst, says, since top secret is the U.S. government's highest official classification level, this revelation exploded months of denials from the Clinton presidential campaign that Hillary had done no wrong. Now, again, she was her excuse was that no. This is simply a post hoc overclassification. Still did nothing wrong. Most controversially, Schindler says, Hillary and her mouthpieces have kept pushing the line that none of this information was marked classified when it appeared in her personal emails, despite the fact that this claim, even if true, doesn't mitigate any disclosure of classified information. Schindler says her defense seems to be that neither she nor anybody on her staff were able to recognize that top secret information was actually top secret information, which is hardly a ringing endorsement, Schindler writes, of Hillary's qualifications to be our next commander-in-chief. So Schindler says, what's in those 22 emails that the intelligence community says can't be released, and Hillary Clinton says, not to do about nothing, just go ahead and release them all. Schindler says anything that the overzealous, or excuse me, says that contrary to the assertions of Team Clinton that the information was benign, a nothing burger, to cite her allies, implying that the overzealous intelligence community has classified information that doesn't need protection. Their contents are top secret with good reason. Today, Fox News has reported that those 22 top secret emails included, quote, operational intelligence that involves espionage sources and methods, adding that lives have been put at risk by Clinton's mishandling of this information. John Schindler writes, I can confirm that the Fox News report, which lacks any specifics about what exactly was compromised, is accurate. And he says what was actually in those top secret emails found on Hillary's unclassified personal bathroom server was colossally damaging to our national security and has put lives at risk. He says discussions with intelligence community officials have revealed that Ms. Clinton's, quote, unclassified emails included holy grail items of American espionage, such as the true names of CIA intelligence officers serving overseas undercover. Worse, he says, some of those exposed are serving under non-official cover. NOCs, he writes, are the pointy end of the CIA spear, and they are always at risk of exposure, which is what Ms. Clinton's emails have done. He says people really go to jail for breaking this law. John Kiriku, a former CIA officer, recently emerged from 2 years in prison for unauthorized disclosure of classified information, exposing the identity of an agency colleague who was serving undercover. He says anyone possessing political memory will recall that this law was also the centerpiece of the 2003 scandal surrounding Valerie Plame, a CIA NOC officer whose identity appeared in the media after it was exposed by the George W. Bush White House. Schindler writes, Ms. Plame became a liberal icon of sorts, complete with high glamour, while the affair became an obsession for much of the mainstream media, despite the fact that the spy was physically unharmed by the leak. Schindler says that neither Ms. Plame, who was in New Hampshire campaigning for Hillary Clinton last week, nor much of the media seem interested in their candidates' far greater compromise of classified information, including the identities of NOCs like Valerie Plame once was. And he says Hillary's emails also include the names of foreigners who are on the CIA payroll, according to intelligence community officials. He says since it can be safely assumed that several foreign intelligence agencies intercepted Ms. Clinton's unencrypted communications, this directly threatens the lives of the exposed individuals. A senior intelligence community official said, quote, it's a death sentence. If we're lucky, only agents, not our officers, will get killed because of this. If we're lucky, only agents, not our officers, will get killed because of this. Schindler says the CIA and the entire intelligence community are in a panic mode right now, trying to determine which of our intelligence officers and agents have been compromised by Emailgate. Now, again, these are only the emails that were turned over by Hillary Clinton, right? At a minimum, Schindler writes, valuable covers have been blown, careers have been ruined, lives have been put at serious risk. He says our spy's greatest concern now is what is still in Hillary's emails that investigators have yet to find. And Schindler asks, what about those 30,000 emails that Ms. Clinton had deleted? An exasperated Pentagon counterintelligence official, quote, I'll spend the rest of my career trying to figure out what classified information was in those. Everybody is mad as hell right now. And he said the worst part is that Moscow and Beijing have that information, but our intelligence community never will. Hopefully we can get John Schindler on the program this week to talk about the latest here, but he has been doing yeoman's work there at Observer. Obviously, as a former intelligence analyst, John has a lot of sources still within the IC community. And again, he is breaking news, not just covering the news and analyzing the news or regurgitating somebody else's story, like kind of I just did here. So go read John direct at Observer.com. When we come back after a quick timeout, Mr. Bob Owens of Bearing Arms will join us on the program. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Mark Gilardi with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net
Wow.
for leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and da-da-da, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised 12 grand. And we did that for a couple of years, and then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need a staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. Because I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and you know the little girl's got a wig on, she's been through hell. I can say hell, can I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago. 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah. And Mark, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling our love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years old. Or this is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it, and it's like, So I am an armorer. Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids, you know.
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company coming up top of the hour. We've got the heroes of the day, sponsored by our friends at AgCorp Defense. A doozy of a deal of the day, and the good guy as well. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Bearing Arms, Mr. Bob Owens is with us. How you doing, Bob?
Doing fine, sir. How are you?
I'm good. You finally made it back from Las Vegas?
I did. It wasn't a horrible, horrible thing.
Oh, good.
I spent all my time out there shooting. So.
Well, you did apparently do a little bit more than shooting, because you've got a piece at Bearing Arms. Welcome to Obama's Legacy. Gang Warland, and you say one of an interesting series of conversations you had was with a highly placed NGO official about the chilling effect that left-wing attacks on law enforcement have had on proactive policing. This individual told you, Bob, the Ferguson effect is real.
Yeah, it's a very sad thing, but you know, I did speak to an official at a non-government organization who works very closely with military and police, and you know, he deals with agencies all the time, and one thing he is seeing is a lot of officers, if they've got their time in, instead of having to deal with a public that has been turned against the police by the Obama administration and various left-wing groups, these guys are retiring. So we're losing our most experienced police officers because they don't want to run the risk of being involved in an incident and then having, you know, whether it's justified or not, having their names dragged through the mud and their careers ruined and their families' lives ruined.
If you've got your 25 or your 30 years in other words, get out now.
Exactly. And it's a sad thing. We're losing our most experienced police officers. We're having a lot of those who remain because it's, you know, there's not a real straight pipe transition between law enforcement and most civilian careers. So, you know, a lot of these guys would love to get out if they could, but they can't. And so what they're doing, instead of going out and proactively policing and putting the bad guys in jail, is they're sitting in squad cars and answering radio calls and trying not to get themselves in a situation where they're going to end up being blamed when the next Michael Brown attacks a cop.
You know, it's interesting. I was reading a story earlier today. I'm trying to find it right now. Here we go. Some Chicago police officers say the ACLU effect led to the deadliest January since 2001. Chicago Sun-Times reporting that you've got the ACLU in an agreement with the Chicago Police Department. Every time a Chicago police officer now makes a stop, they have to complete more extensive forms documenting the stop that was made. In fact, I think it's gone from one page to now two pages. So, in essence, doubling the paperwork every time you make contact with someone. And so you've got officers who are saying, you know, forget it, because the fewer stops we make, again, the less risk there is going to be that someone could come along, second guess what we did, and then pursue charges against us.
Well, and not only is there, you know, we don't want to do it because there's more paperwork, but even if they wanted to, they can't because there's more paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their time's being chewed up filling out silly paperwork for self-important fools. And, you know, officers are not here to fill out forms. They're here to protect the population from the predators amongst us. And because of the Obama administration, and I place this squarely on the president's shoulders, you know, dating back to 2009 with the whole Henry Louis Gates beer summit fiasco.
This goes back to the way the president has treated law enforcement from the moment he stepped into office, which is with nothing but contempt.
You know, and again, you look at the numbers in Chicago, 51 homicides in January, a record high for Chicago, 29 in January of 2015. Chicago Sun-Times says that the total number of shooting incidents more than doubled, 119 in January 2015, 242 last month, 292 shooting victims last month compared to just 136 in January of 2015. And at the same time, again, 79% fewer documentations of stops in January of this year than the same period in 2015. You point out as well, Bob, that the increase in violence in a lot of, well, I shouldn't say a lot, but in many of our U.S. cities is really just that. It's an increase of violence within U.S. cities, right? But you get outside of places like Chicago, Baltimore, which saw over 300 homicides last year. In most of the country, violent crime continues to drop.
Absolutely. You know, per capita, we're at the lowest homicide rate in recorded U.S. history since the FBI started tracking that stat nationwide in 1960. There's not a whole lot of drive-bys in Farmville, I don't think.
There are not. Every now and then you'll see a story, you know, as I said, every now and then you'll see a story of an aggravated robbery or something like that in Farmville or the surrounding area. But no, generally speaking, it's pretty quiet.
Yeah, and that's the way it is throughout most of the country. Primarily where we're seeing a rise in violent crime are in major metropolitan areas where police officers have been forced by politics to take a defensive posture to defend themselves from basically left-wing wackos who are trying to find any excuse they are to attack the police. So you can have groups like Black Lives Matter and the various left-wing front groups that they represent come in and just tear the police a new one. And it's all politically motivated.
Talking again with Bob Owens of Bearing Arms. So did your source there at SHOT indicate any optimism about 2016, Bob, or not?
We actually just never got around to that portion of it. But I think it's probably a fairly safe assessment that most of this nation's 800,000 law enforcement officers are probably going to overwhelmingly be voting for the candidate, whoever that may be, who is least likely to treat them like criminals.
There you go. Bob, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir, and look forward to talking again very soon.
Absolutely, can anytime.
All right, thanks again. Bob Owens joining us from Bearing Arms. .com. And by the way, I think I may have underestimated the scope of the change there in the city of Chicago. It was not a one-page form that these officers were filling out. It's basically a contact card, like a 3x5 index card, which is now turned into a two-page form every time an officer, again, makes contact, whether it's a traffic stop, whether it's I'm seeing somebody selling drugs at the corner, I'm going to go frisk them. Now a two-page form that you have to fill out. DNAinfo.com points out that in the first 11 days of 2016, Chicago officers filed 3,916 investigative stop reports compared to 16,698 in the first 11 days of 2015. Gun confiscations down more than 35% this year in Chicago. Arrests down more than 35% this year in Chicago. DNA Info says some law enforcement experts say the drop in investigative stops pits the need for extreme measures to stem shooting in extremely violent neighborhoods against a push initiated by the ACLU to protect the civil rights of innocent people stopped on the street by police. And it's all happening as morale among the rank and file has reached an all-time low in a police department that is the subject of a federal probe in the wake of the Laquan McDonald shooting. The lengthier reports required when investigative street stops are made by police stems from an agreement negotiated between City Hall and the ACLU The agreement was to prevent a lawsuit related to the police department's lack of documentation of investigative stops that an ACLU study alleged unfairly targets innocent minorities. The website DNA Info says, so far, Rahm Emanuel's administration has acknowledged the downturn in investigative stops without hammering rank-and-file officers publicly. Well, that's probably a wise move for a mayor who hasn't made a lot of wise moves lately. The police spokesman, Anthony Guglielmi, says, quote, district-wide training is just about to start. That's back on January 18th. And we anticipate the numbers to increase as more users are trained. Mm-hmm. DNA Info says Emanuel has publicly expressed sympathy for officers who are, quote, operating obviously with greater public scrutiny than you can't ignore. He has made more regular visits to police roll calls in an apparent attempt to show his support for the rank and file. Still, DNA Info says law enforcement experts will tell you the currently tense situation boils down to a question of Chicago's priorities. Is it more important to go after the flood of illegal guns into Chicago that City Hall and police officials have consistently blamed for the city's shooting epidemic, or to require better oversight of how police stop people on the street to protect against racial profiling? More important, or moreover, the website says, will the new intense scrutiny on how police officers do their job by politicians, civil rights groups, the media, and the U.S. Justice Department inadvertently cause a loss of focus on doing everything possible to fight against violence in Chicago's neighborhoods, infamous for senseless shootings? ACLU Senior Staff Attorney Karen Shelley says Chicago police can and should be able to do both. It's important, she says, that Chicago's police department fights crime without violating the constitutional rights of innocent Chicagoans, especially minorities living in violent parts of town. Well, I would agree with that. I think most people would. And again, my personal feeling is I'm not a huge fan of stop and frisk. I, for instance, do not agree with Michael Bloomberg that one way to reduce violent crime is to take young minority males between the ages of 15 and 24 and throw them all up against a wall and frisk them. I think that most of the time you're going to find people who aren't doing anything wrong, and occasionally you might find somebody who is, but that innocent people should not be thrown up against a wall and frisked simply for being a young minority male. But that's just me. We'll talk a little bit more about this topic, as well as the hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, our deal of the day, our good guy of the day, coming up at the top of Hour 3. Stick around. We have a lot more. NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this quick timeout.
Speaking with Chris Brackett of Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak, and that is on Outdoor Channel and also Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. Chris, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing amazing.
Well, we got a lot to talk about, so let's get started. First, tell folks, what is Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil? What's that all about?
So Fear No Evil is a deeper, darker look at why any crazy person would sit in a tree from dusk till dark and do all the things that we do as hunters. And, you know, sometimes you find yourself just, why am I doing this? I'm sitting here and I'm freezing to death. But it's a, you know, deep, dark look at big game hunting, and it takes you on a roller coaster of emotions. Most people say, you know, our show is different than others. Ours really, we try to capture a 30-minute movie. So each one is different than the other one, and you know, some of them may be funny, some of them may make you cry, other ones, you know, takes you on a roller coaster, and it, you know, the industry is a change in that way, and we wanted to really make a one where your wife will sit down and watch, you know, and she doesn't watch normal hunting shows.
And I think that's great, Chris, because it's good to get inside the mind of a hunter, because most people who don't hunt look at them going, why in the world would you want to do that?
Yeah, you have different classifications of different outdoor television, right? You have entertainment, you have education, and then you have this kind of, you know, the kind of the old standard of, okay, here comes a deer, cutaways, this and that. And and everybody likes one for a different. And for years, for the last 10 years, we just decided to make it completely organic in its own art.
So tell me, and I know we could probably talk about this all afternoon.
Right, I love it. Yeah.
What is it? Where do you get that passion? What can you tell people in 30 to 40 seconds here why you do what you do? Why is it so, to the non-hunter, so great?
For me, it's absolutely, it is in my blood. Number one, I can't not go after something. Number two is that, you know, God kind of put it on me to inspire and educate through entertainment, and that's my mule. That's my entertainment.
That was excellent. So that's Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak. That's on Outdoor Channel. Now let's shift gears with Chris. Let's talk about Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. What is that all about?
So Arrow Affliction is the almost opposite of Fear No Evil. Fear No Evil is this dark. It's almost like, you know, you love chocolate ice cream, you love vanilla ice cream. Well, it's kind of the lighter side of bow hunting. Fun with arrows, shoot everything, hunt the way you and me got a BB gun and did everything that we could think of as 10, 12 year olds, and now we're grown men doing the same thing with arrows. Hunting bullfrogs, ducks, doves, geese, pheasants out of the air, just shooting and really pushing yourself.
So is it tough for you, Chris? I mean, that's a lot of plates to spin, a lot of balls to juggle, to have those two TV shows in production. Does it get tough?
Yeah, and we went a different route. I was born and raised in the Midwest, and I had nothing, and I created it from nothing. So it truly is an American dream being able to do this. But at the same time, what everybody really has to understand is that I don't have any kids. I don't even have a mortgage on a house. I rent a house. I give everything to my art to inspire and educate all the viewers. And so for us to do it, we're on the road, you know, most of the year. I started in September 1. I just ended 5 days ago killing a giant Boone and Crockett deer in Ohio. And I've devoted my entire life for everybody else to enjoy the adventures that we go on.
Your passion is total. It's all out.
it's full throttle, man.
It's Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak on Outdoor Channel and Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. Chris, how can people get more information about Chris Brackett and about your great shows?
Well, the best way is you can go to fearnoevil.com, the website.
Thank you so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joining us for the Liberty Update. Jazz Shaw of Hot Air joining us on the program a little bit later on in the hour as well. On the rarely discussed support, he says, for gun rights among black voters. We have the Heroes of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. Our Deal of the Day, our Good Guy of the Day. As a matter of fact, you were talking about Chicago and DNA Info, the website there in Chicago. Quoting mayoral spokesman Adam Collins, who says there is no question that there's much more attention being paid to our officers right now. But there's also no question we have thousands of brave men and women in this city that put their lives on the line each day and work tirelessly to keep our city safe. You don't hear their stories because they're doing their jobs, but they are not deterred. They are determined to continue driving a reduction in major crimes and to build bridges of understanding with our residents. Which is happy talk, but it also, if you notice, doesn't acknowledge any of the concerns of the thousands of brave men and women in the city of Chicago who are police officers. It's an attaboy, attagirl, pat on the head. That's about it. Meanwhile, the head of the FOP... In Chicago, says that he hopes the fractured relationship can be repaired, the fractured relationship between the police and City Hall. And he says that in the end, the federal investigation might be a win for the officers that the FOP represents. He says, we've met with the Justice Department investigators twice now. We have a good sense of what they're looking at, and we are okay with the direction that they're going. He said, we think it's going to end in something that will eventually benefit police officers with things like more training, state-of-the-art equipment, and more tools in the tool belt. We think it'll be a good thing. We might even get more additional officers on the street. DNA Info says how it will all play out remains uncertain as Chicago cops fight crime in such a politically charged, federally investigated working environment. The problem is much bigger than a little extra paperwork. And indeed, it is. Now, our first hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, actually from Chicago. The Chicago Sun-Times reporting it was early Sunday morning in the Woodlawn neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. It's about 5:15 in the morning. 30-year-old man broke into a woman's home, and began to beat her. The 28-year-old woman was able to get to a handgun. Don't know if it was hers, although it looks like it was. The Chicago Sun-Times says the woman has a valid firearms owner identification card. And she shot him during a struggle. Police say the woman knew the man. The incident was domestic-related. Detectives are conducting an investigation, but right now it looks like this was a case of self-defense, given that he broke into her home and attacked her. Again, thankfully, this woman was able to have a gun in her home, given that until 2010, the city of Chicago banned handgun ownership. She is our first hero of the day. Our second hero of the day from WJTV. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. That's our good guy of the day. I'll get to that in a minute. From the Morgan County Citizen in Georgia, a Buckhead woman able to defend herself from a suspected armed robber. It was last Thursday morning. Janet Willis is the owner of Buckhead Grocery. She's 71 years old. She says a 21-year-old man, Prince William Dennis, entered her store at approximately 5 o'clock in the morning. What is it with guys attacking women at 5 o'clock in the morning? Prince William Dennis entered her store at approximately 5 a.m., demanded the keys to Willis's vehicle, which is parked in front of the store. Janet Willis said, he said, I want your car. I said, so do I. Which is a pretty good answer. She hit the panic button under the counter. And she says the man saw and became agitated and forceful. He told her, quote, I have killed my mother. And then he mumbled something and said he had stolen a van and he was going to kill me if I didn't give him the keys. She said the man followed her while she went to retrieve the car keys. Meanwhile, a customer there in the store came out of the bathroom. And Dennis turned to look at the guy coming out of the men's room. Janet Willis said, I knew he was getting perturbed. I was afraid he was going to jump me. So while his back was turned, she grabbed a pistol that she keeps at the store. She said, when he turned around, I said, I'll blow your guts out all over this store. And then I let him outside. Marched him out the door. He got into a 2008 Chevrolet Uplander with a flat tire and then left, driving along the road until sparks from the vehicle's rim caught the car on fire. The vehicle had been reported stolen out of Columbia County. Then the guy went to a home on Parks Mill Road, knocked on the door, and asked for help. According to reports, a man said he transported Dennis to the another gas station where he required a ride to exit 113 on Madison Highway. That is where the Morgan County Sheriff's Office spotted Mr. Dennis standing outside of a convenience store. They detained him. Morgan County fire personnel extinguished the fire. Meanwhile, Captain Chris Bish of the Morgan County Sheriff's Office praised Janet Willis for protecting herself. She said, I admire her for doing what she did to thwart the robbery. I'm grateful for the outcome. He said, fortunately, in this case, he was not armed, and her response forced him to flee. Meanwhile, Janet Willis says this is not the first time that she has had to defend herself. She said it was more than 30 years ago. She was working at a grocery store in Covington, Georgia, when a man became belligerent and threatened her. She said she learned from that experience. You have to stay calm. If you stay calm, they stay calm. If you get upset, they get upset. She said 30 years ago, this guy pushed her up against the cash register. And then she pulled out her .45 and pointed at him and asked him, do you want this or do you want the door? She said he chose the door. So 71-year-old Janet Willis, all 5 feet, 1 inch of her, defending herself against a 21-year-old would-be robber there in Morgan County, Georgia, our second hero of the day. Our deal of the day. Told you this was a doozy for you from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. It's the story of a case that is before the Ohio State Supreme Court right now. And it involves the ability for police to use rape kits that were taken decades ago and actually reopen cases, maybe even refile charges based on DNA evidence and DNA analysis that wasn't available at the time. Demetrius Jones is at the center of this case. He was, back in 1993, accused of raping a 23-year-old. But the investigation was closed pretty quickly because they couldn't find the victim at the time. They were able to take evidence from the victim, and they were able to obtain Demetrius Jones's DNA in that evidence kit. Plain Dealer says he was indicted in 2013, one day before the statute of limitations ran out. But a trial judge throughout the case against Demetrius Jones said that it was fundamentally unjust to his defense. He could not defend himself as well as he could have had the case been filed 20 years ago. The Ohio 8th District Court of Appeals upheld that judge's decision in the summer, and now the Ohio State Supreme Court is considering this case. This will the decision by the Supreme Court will have an impact there in the state of Ohio regarding similar cases where DNA evidence is now being analyzed when it was not a, a possibility at the time of the alleged crime. But what struck me about this story is the fact that Demetrius Jones, this is not his only run-in with the law. Far from it, as a matter of fact. The assistant county prosecutor in the case reminded the judges that Demetrius Jones has a, quote, long criminal history, which includes nearly 30 felonies, including violent offenses and multiple rape allegations. Back in 2011, for instance, Demetrius Jones was charged with 7 counts of rape, kidnapping, and felonious assault. But in a plea agreement with prosecutors, here's your deal. In a plea deal with prosecutors, those 7 rape charges were thrown out. The kidnapping charge was thrown out, and Demetrius Jones pleaded guilty to a single count of felonious assault. Cleveland Plain Dealer says Jones, meanwhile, pleaded guilty last year to a theft offense for sleeping in a stolen car when he was homeless, just days after being released from prison in another case. He is serving the remainder of an 18-month prison sentence and is set to be released later this year. So in 2007, this guy who was facing 7 rape charges, a kidnapping charge, a felonious assault charge, takes a plea to just the felonious assault charge, and by 2015, he's out. He's on the streets and arrested again and back behind bars again. Now, is this evidence that the system is working? After all, the guy, again, he gets arrested, he gets prosecuted, he gets time behind bars. There are those who would say this is evidence that the system is working. Works just fine. Only thing we need are a few more laws on the books, and it'll run even better. I'm not one of those people, to be really honest with you. Because I look at a story like this and think, how does somebody rack up 30 felonies in their life? Demetrius Jones is now 49 years of age. He has a felony for almost every year of adulthood, which is saying something because he is spending some time behind bars. Not much, but a little bit of time behind bars where he is away from society and cannot commit another crime. And the thing is, the reason why we are hearing about Demetrius Jones is not because his crimes led the nightly news. It's not even because his plea bargain was so outrageous that the police reporter, the court reporter, saw this and said, holy cow, I got a report on this. The reason why we know about Demetrius Jones is because his case is going before the Ohio Supreme Court as to whether or not one of these charges that he has faced over his 49 years on earth can proceed to trial. And that's probably important for Demetrius Jones. I'm sure it's important for the police and the prosecutors and the defense attorneys and the judge. But even more broadly, when and where do we find time to talk about the system that allows someone like Demetrius Jones to rack up the criminal history that he has? Besides our deal of the day segment, I suppose. And Demetrius Jones is, in fact, our deal of the day. Our good guy of the day from WJTV down in Mississippi, Channel 12 in Mississippi, a Palahatchie, Mississippi police officer being hailed as a hero after jumping into a flooded creek to save a woman and her daughter. It was last Tuesday. Creek's usually pretty low, according to the local media, but it was not that day. Flooded with rainwater. Christy Irby swerved off a muddy road. She ran into the creek. She managed to get out of the car. She had her two-year-old daughter, Allie, with her, but they could not get out of the creek itself. Someone called in the accident. Palahatchie Police Officer Shane Gibson responded, took off his utility belt, went into the water, and was able to rescue Christy Irby and her daughter, Allie, from the floodwaters. So Officer Shane Gibson of the Palahatchie, Mississippi Police Department, thank you, sir, for being one of the many good guys out there. All right, when we come back here on NRA News, Cam and Company, Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom joining us for this week's Liberty Update. Later on in the hour, we'll talk with Jazz Shaw of Hot Air. Stick around. We have a lot more NRA News, Cam and Company coming up right after the break.
I'm speaking with Sergeant Major Lance Nutt. He's president and founder of Sheepdog Impact Assistance. Tell us what Sheepdog Impact Assistance is all about.
Well, when we refer to the term of sheepdog, it's referring to one of society's protectors. It's the men and women that serve in the military, law enforcement, fire and rescue ranks. It's that type of man or woman that's willing to put their life on the line for you and me, for everyday service and the things that we live and take for granted. It takes a unique individual to go out there and make sure that we're able to appreciate the freedoms that exist for us. And when we talk about society's protectors, it's truly its sheepdogs, those men and women willing to give it all.
So where did this concept come from?
Well, for us and myself as a Marine of 28 years, it was quickly understanding with multiple deployments under my back and so many of my own Marines and soldiers and sailors that I had served with, seeing the difficulties they had in returning home. Part of that was that continued service opportunity. When you step away from something that means so much to you and having given so much of your life in service, we felt that we needed an organization that would give you that opportunity to continue giving back to your country. We initially formed as a disaster response organization and have morphed into so much more that truly defines who and what we are as individuals, our members and our volunteers. But more importantly, we're making sure that those men and women that have suffered a traumatic injury, and that could be emotional or physical trauma, that we give them the opportunity to get up off their butts and continue to live their lives.
It's awesome. Sergeant Major Lance Nutt with Sheepdog Impact Assistance. How can we get more information about your wonderful organization?
Well, we encourage people to visit our website at www.sheepdogia.org, and that's that'll give them an opportunity to learn a lot more about what we're accomplishing and how we're helping these men and women continue on with their lives.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Speaking with Juliana Crowder with A Girl and a Gun. Juliana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous.
Tell folks, what is A Girl and a Gun?
A Girl and a Gun is an organization for women, and we get them out to the shooting range. We have activities for ladies who are brand new all the way through experienced shooters. So we offer kind of like a social club. But we also are being very serious about safety and training, and then also helping women reach certain goals with firearms that they might have.
Why did you start this?
It was really important for me to see more women out in the competitive shooting sports and also taking more responsibility for their personal safety. So I wanted to have kind of like a happy hour or a non-confrontational experience at the range.
Right.
So we just started hosting Girls Night Out and making it a social experience and then slowly introducing the more serious training aspect.
Well, whether it's shooting sports or hunting or anything, there's much more than just the aspect of picking up the gun. You're right. It's a social thing that involves friends, family, mentoring, whatever it involves, it's
right.
So important to make that work. Good. So just give us a flavor of some of the stuff you like to do.
So we like to go shoot IDPA and three gun. We have ladies going on hunts for the first time.
Cool.
We have ladies learning about archery.
All right, good.
We share experience about holsters, guns, different gear and equipment that might work better for certain body types.
A lot different for men and women.
And we're also sharing the emotional experience of being a firearms owner, because for some, it could be a traumatic transition from something that's happened in their life, and for others it's a very joyful experience of liberation and empowerment. So we really are offering something for everyone.
Awesome. How can people get more information about A Girl and a Gun?
They can find us at agirlandagun.org, and we're also on Facebook.
Juliana Crowder, A Girl and a Gun, thank you so much for being on NRA News. You're always there for us, but thank you for what you do. Thank you for your passion. You keep it up, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Cam Edwards, your host, and joining us for the Liberty Update this week, our friend Tim Lee is with us. How are you, Tim?
Doing well. How are you guys doing back there? You're finally digging out, I hope.
The snow is gone now here in Farmville. I think it's mostly gone up in Northern Virginia. You've avoided all of this?
Well, I was actually back last week, and so, no, I ran into it, but I wasn't in there when it hit, so I was never stranded. I didn't have to deal with any of the closures or cancellations or anything like that. So, I avoided the blitz, but I was sort of in there for the aftermath. So, my heart bleeds a little bit. Instead, now I'm in 65-degree weather, and it only bleeds so much. But, it's funny, though. I had just left the city when it hit, and a part of me sort of missed it. You know, I lived through Snowmageddon back in 2010, and part of me sort of, there's a certain fun aspect to it. You know, obviously, your heart goes out to people who actually did suffer. You know, a few people died, and some people really did suffer tangible harm. But apart from that, you know, sometimes you get snowed in, you play out with the dogs, you dig some tunnels in the snow. That can be kind of fun. So part of me missed it. But, yeah, it's the aftermath, you know. And I don't know if it'll be that way this year. I think temperatures have warmed up quite a bit. But back in 2010, you may remember, temperatures just really didn't warm up until March. And we had another big snowstorm just a few weeks prior in late December of 2009. Mm-hmm. So, it wasn't until March, maybe even April, until all the snow was gone and all the grime accumulates on it and stuff like that. So hopefully that doesn't happen this year. But apart from that, sometimes it can be an adventure. So, part of me missed it. But
I remember 2010 well, and good for you for your 60-degree days. I suppose that should we let people know what's going on, why you're enjoying 60-degree days and not miserable in D.C. right now?
Well, just my commute got a little bit longer, so I still come in, you know, pretty much every week or every other week. But, you know, just leaving for a little bit warmer climes. But, you know, I'm still essentially back there, so not a whole lot has changed in that regard. Like I said, I was back last week, so it's, you know, still same capacity the whole bit. Just I get a little bit of a Farmville, just a little bit further distance, and so that's all.
yeah, a lot further distance. All right, so what are you covering at CFIF.org this week?
Well, last week, you know, our Liberty Update piece, I wrote about Senator Tom Cotton, and I know you and I have discussed criminal justice reform here on the show quite a few times,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, somewhere where I'm kind of in the middle, I think a lot of people are getting carried away, and including a lot of conservatives and libertarians who are usually sort of more the tough-on-crime, law-and-order types, but, you know, there's a broad movement out there for criminal justice reform, and to a certain extent, we totally favor that. For instance, there's about 5,000 criminal statutes at the federal level and about 300,000 criminalized regulations at the federal level. The Department of Justice can't even count them all. So a lot of things are crimes that people don't even know are crimes, and that's a big problem. And so we certainly, and I personally, favor reform in that regard. And so, you know, we have problems with that. On the other hand, we can go too far. And what's going on right now as part of a very broad legislative criminal justice reform in the Senate is a bill sponsored by a lot of Republicans. Tom Cornyn is behind it. Obviously, people like Rand Paul, but even guys like Mike Lee, whom I respect very, very much, are behind this as well. And so it goes to reforming things that need to be reformed, like just this exaggerated number of criminal laws at the federal level. Also, you and I have talked before about mens rea, which is a criminal mind. Mens rea is a Latin term in criminal law, meaning, you know, to be convicted of a crime, you actually have to have intended to commit that crime. So if you do something sort of negligently or innocently, we don't punish you as much as if you actually intended to commit a crime. Unfortunately, a lot of federal laws have gotten away from having a mens rea requirement. So you can be driving down the road and committing a felony and you don't even know it. And unfortunately, you can do prison time for those sorts of things. So that's another area where some of these criminal justice reforms at the Senate level are good. Here's the problem. This proposed legislation in the Senate also does away with many mandatory minimum sentences. That's where we draw the line, and that is a bad idea. Granted, there are individual cases out there that you could find where mandatory minimums were applied improperly. The problem with getting rid of them is that mandatory minimums played a large role in cutting crime over the last two decades. I know another thing you and I have talked about on this show a lot is just the astounding reduction in the American crime rate. Murders, the murder rate in the United States has been cut in half mm-hmm. over about the last 20 years. A large part of that is the get tough on crime measures that were instituted after the late 80s and early 90s when crime just seemed out of control. The reason is this. It incapacitates criminals. A very, very small percentage of the population commits almost all of its crimes. And so what happens is, Rudy Giuliani pursued this. It's part of the broken windows policing theory. When you start busting people for crimes that you used to not prosecute, like jumping a subway turnstile or loitering or vandalism, things like that, what you start to notice is by taking those guys off the street, they're incapacitated by being in jail or prison from committing other crimes because they tend to be the same people that commit armed robbery or murder or assault. And so you see a reduction in crime simply because you're incapacitating the people that tend to commit most crimes. Criminal conduct is not evenly distributed across the population. So what I'm getting at here is, you know, previously, before all of these get-tough-on-crime statutes of the early 90s under people like Rudy Giuliani, we needed mandatory minimums because people were just getting dismissed by judges, and the criminal justice system was too lenient. It had a very positive effect. Unfortunately, now some who are promoting some good reforms go too far by trying to get rid of mandatory minimums. And Senator Tom Cotton, the freshman senator out of Arkansas, is actually standing up against it. So kudos to him. He is saying, look, we do need to reform some parts of our criminal justice system, but getting rid of these mandatory minimums goes too far. And so what I wrote about last week is essentially applauding Senator Cotton and a few other Republicans who are standing up and saying, let's not go too far here. Let's not get carried away. And that's quite a great bit of leadership from a freshman senator like that, without pointing fingers and without being, you know, sort of the type to demonize his opponents. Again, we don't endorse candidates or oppose them, but just a great, great deal of intellectual and moral respect for Senator Cotton.
You know, and it's interesting, Tim, because one of the things that I've learned recently is that about 97% of federal cases result in a plea bargain.
Right.
They never go to trial. You know, and so when you talk about the phrase criminal justice reform, that is it's a small phrase that can mean a whole lot of different things, right? Because the criminal justice system is enormous. And I would say that there are a lot of problems within the criminal justice system. This is one of the things that bugs me to no end, that you know, the vast majority of these cases end up in plea bargains. So, you know, if you've got, let's say, a mandatory minimum sentence, that may be applied, but it may also not be anywhere near the amount of time that an individual would have been eligible to serve had they actually been prosecuted on the charges that they were arrested on, right?
Yeah. A similar thing goes on in the civil justice system. I never practiced criminal law, but mm-hmm. I did practice employment law and commercial litigation for years and years. And, you know, anybody who does that will tell you that almost no cases start out go to trial. Most of them settle at one point or another. What happens is, if you have something like a mandatory minimum, that can extract a more stringent settlement from the potential defendant. So if somebody, you know, a criminal defendant is told, hey, look, the mandatory minimum here, if you go to trial and lose, is 10 years, you can plead down to this reduced charge and get 2 years. You know, without the mandatory minimum, there's less leverage for the prosecutor to do that. I sort of started the segment by saying there are certainly individual cases where, you know, you get somebody who is in jail for, you know, a little bit longer time than maybe they should have given the crime. Those cases actually are pretty rare, though. There's this sort of myth out there of a guy who gets 25 years for possession of a joint. That's just really not the case. Most criminals in our prison systems are at the state level, first of all, and, right. and not at the federal level. And most of them are violent criminals. But in terms of somebody who gets busted for drug possession, and, you know, a lot of the horror stories that you hear people like Rand Paul talk about, usually it's like their third or fourth offense, and usually they're caught with quite a bit. They're not caught with a joint. They're caught with a lot. And usually they're engaged in the sale of it. So we're not talking about an innocent kid who's on the honor roll that gets busted for, you know, a joint that's doing this. I'm not saying that those cases don't exist every once in a while in a blue moon, but overwhelmingly there's this myth out there of a lot of people who are in prison that don't deserve to be there, and it really is a myth. I mean, most of those people that are busted for drug possession did have a lot. It's their multiple offense. So, you know, by the third or fourth time you're getting busted for this, it's hard for me to sympathize with you for going to jail when, you know, you could have learned your lesson a long time ago. And the other thing I would point out is a lot of those cases even are plea bargains where, you know, they were involved in something more serious, mm-hmm. but they pleaded down to a drug possession charge, you know, as part of the plea bargain. So I'm just saying a lot of people need to be careful. We certainly favor criminal justice reform in a lot of areas. Mandatory minimums, though, serve a very, very important purpose. And over the last 20 years, they've played a key role in reducing crime, especially violent crime in America, and we just can't afford to get rid of them. It would be really throwing out the baby with the bathwater here.
Talking again with Tim Lee with the Center for Individual Freedom about his commentary piece at CFIF. And, you know, Tim, also at CFIF a couple of days ago, you've got a piece. I know this is not your piece, but Betsy McCoy on the CDC dropping the ball on the Zika virus, a virus that probably most Americans didn't even know existed, let's say 2 weeks ago. And now, you know, it appears that this this virus is spreading here within the United States and certainly in South and Central America. This is growing, it seems, well beyond the ability for public health professionals to contain this disease.
Yeah, this one, it's one of those scares, you know, where you're not quite sure what to think. You know, is this another false alarm, or is this something where, you know, we really do need to be alarmed? I'll tell you that the consequences of people who have this disease and for births and things like that, very, very serious. Unfortunately, the problem is that a lot of times when you get the federal government involved, even on a serious issue, they end up blowing it. And so, you know, that's the perils of bureaucracy and big government and the leaky bucket principle, as it were. So that's, you know, that.
Well, and when you you've got, you know, an agency that, you know, let's put it this way. I'm seeing far more stories right now, Tim, written by, you know, anti-gun advocates who are calling on the CDC to investigate the root causes of gun violence than I am seeing, you know, hey, CDC, get on this Zika virus, right? Seems to me like the CDC should be more concerned about things like the Zika virus than your gun ownership or my gun ownership.
Yeah, that's unfortunately, you know, when you hear people complain that the federal government and the CDC isn't targeting, gun violence, well, not a disease. But at any rate, with regard to this, you know, there are connections with a lot of environmental issues and environmental extremists. DDT, you know, a lot of people hear that word and they sort of recoil as if it's sort of nuclear radioactive material. It's not. A lot of the concerns about DDT were totally overblown. And in a lot of countries where malaria still exists and it existed up until a very short time ago, DDT could have saved a lot of lives. But instead, because, you know, of the silent spraying and other exaggerations that people engaged in, a lot of these chemicals got banned. And the consequences were horrible for human health. They, you know, things like DDT don't necessarily have a very significant environmental impact, but what they do have when they're banned is a significant impact in terms of harming human health. And so, you know, that's another area. We got to pay attention to these diseases rather than necessarily listen to the Ralph Naders of the world that, you know, make their living off of sounding the alarm, in many cases falsely, unfortunately. And people really can suffer. So hopefully this isn't another instance of it.
All right. Listen, Tim, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. And hopefully next time you're up in D.C., maybe our paths will cross.
We will. I'll do it, and I'll sit in on the studio just like regular times.
Fantastic. All right. We'll talk to you soon. Tim Lee joins us from the Center for Individual Freedom here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Jazz Shaw of Hot Air on the program after a quick timeout. CNN's Brooke Baldwin asking the Chris Matthews question to some supporters of Bernie Sanders. Actually, a variation of the Chris Matthews question. The Chris Matthews question is, what is the difference between a Democrat and a socialist? And Debbie Wasserman Schultz doesn't want to answer, and Hillary Clinton doesn't want to answer. Brooke Baldwin asked some of Bernie Sanders supporters to simply define socialism, since Bernie Sanders describes himself as a socialist. Majority of them, according to a Mediaite, couldn't say what that means. Don't know. And apparently it's completely unimportant to those voters. Whew. Man, again, don't you think? I didn't think it was old-fashioned to think it was important to actually know what a candidate's ideology was. But maybe if you feel the burn, you don't need to know what the candidate actually thinks about things. All right, when we return after a quick timeout, Mr. Jazz Shaw of Hot Air will join us on the program. Stick around. We have a lot more NRA News, Cam and Company coming up right after this.
I'm here with my good friend Bruce Pyatt, competitive shooter. Bruce, okay, I have to do this interview and introduce you. So what do I say? Okay,
Here, look at this. Bruce, what haven't you done? NRA 2015 World Shooting Championship winner, five-time Bianchi Cup, NRA Action Pistol. I don't know. How do I introduce Bruce Pyatt?
Well, for 30 years, I've been a police officer. I just retired. And the whole time, I've been a competitive shooter. I started when I was a kid. And so I guess I'm...
You're Bruce Pyatt.
I guess.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, Bruce Pyatt. What do I need to say? It's been quite a year for you and continues to be. We're going to talk a little bit about what you've done and what you have coming up. And first of all, let's step back. You said you're a police officer, just retired, and thank you for your service as a police officer. How did you get into competitive shooting from being a police officer?
Well, actually, I was a competitive shooter before being a police officer.
Okay. Right? So how did that happen?
I started when I was a little kid, just shooting. I was bugging my dad to take me hunting. So what he did is signed me up for NRA small bore 50-foot at a local indoor range.
Good for him, because look what he did. He got you out of his hair, and look what he did for you.
Yeah. Well, I grew up right outside of New York City in New Jersey. There isn't places to shoot, so I had to start indoors. And as soon as the junior program's done, men would come in and shoot bullseye pistol. Well, all the kids would go home, and I'd be standing there at the window watching the men, and I wanted to shoot pistol so bad. You know, let me get in there, and sure enough, some of the men would let me come in and fire a few shots. And
that's cool.
Well, as soon as I could get my hands on a pistol, I was doing it. We had some family heirlooms, you know, from my grandfather. My grandfather had a bunch of guns. He was actually an active shooter. So as soon as I could get my hands on pistols, I was doing it.
And look at Bruce, how natural the mentoring process is. Even these are guys who weren't, or you know, their guys are in there shooting. They saw you had interest. They took you and showed you how to do it.
Yep.
And dude, they lit that fire. That is so great. All right, so the 2015 NRA World Shooting Championship winner. That was an interesting competition. That was something new, right?
It was. this is the second year they had it. It's a very interesting format that they supply all the guns, they supply all the ammo, and it's 12 or 13 different disciplines. We shot everything from cowboy action to precision 22 rimfire, all the way to long range.
So it really was
power, everything.
And nothing against three gun, Bruce, but unlike three gun, this really was just the gamut of disciplines.
Every discipline, bullseye, handgun, everything. Yeah. And you couldn't be good at one thing and win there. You had to be good at everything. We had aerial shotgun, you know, trap ski, everything.
I'll tell you, and I was talking to some of the competitors out there, and they had to keep the right attitude because there's some competitors who are really, really good at doing certain things, and they came in and it's like, I can't do this very well. But if you let yourself kind of get caught up in that, it's going to tear you down at a thing like that.
That's exactly true. The guys that were good at IPSC or whatever their specialty was, they would push hard at that specialty and thinking that's going to help them along in the whole competition. And that really is not the case. You had to be steady and stable the whole way through. You couldn't crash anything.
And stay with it. Speaking of Bruce Pyatt, all right, Bruce. So, okay, moving on, 2016, what you got a lot coming up. Once again, here's the schedule of stuff. And this is just a sampling, ladies and gentlemen, what's coming up for Bruce Pyatt.
There's more.
What are you looking forward to the most?
Actually, shooting-wise, in November, the World Bianchi Cup match is down in New Zealand.
Oh, nice.
Shooting is shooting. I like shooting anything. But to go down to New Zealand, it's a beautiful place. I've been there twice.
Would you like me to come and cover it for NRA News Camera Company?
I got a bag. You can carry my bag.
There you go. Boys, we're going to New Zealand. I always wanted to go to New Zealand.
Take the whole crew.
I'm going to say Bruce Pyatt told me to come to New Zealand. All right. So that comes, that kind of stuff like that keeps the fire going, I imagine. Keeps you into it, interested.
Yeah. I've been very fortunate my whole career. You know, police paid my bills, and my sponsors have basically paid for my hobby.
Mention a few of those sponsors.
Caspian Arms, I've been with them my whole shooting career. 29 years I've been with them.
Wow.
Sierra Bullets, Starline Brass, almost the same time. DPMS, Panther Arms.
Cool.
Burris Optics and H&M Black Nitride just came out with them. So
beautiful. All right, before we run out of time, how can we get more information about Bruce Pyatt?
My website, brucepyatt.com.
brucepyatt.com. Bruce Pyatt, what a guy. You're a great guy, and you're a great mentor. We love what you do, and we love having you here on NRA News.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Rolling suicide.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Very pleased to have with us on the program right now our friend from Hot Air. No, not Ed Morrissey. Jazz Shaw. Jazz, how you doing, sir?
Well, I was doing good until you made everybody think you might have had Ed Morrissey. And then, you know, it's just like, well, we get the second fiddle.
No. We usually have Ed on towards the end of the week. So yeah. I just didn't want people to be confused.
I'm just bumping your chops, buddy.
Listen, I love having you on the program. You've got a much better name than Ed, by the way.
That is true.
One of these days, I've got to ask you about the name Jazz. Is that your given name? I'll go ahead and ask you right now. Is that your given name?
Oh my God! Time number 422,116. I've had to tell this story. No, that is a childhood nickname. It comes from my initials, as everybody who has ever checked into it knows that my initials are JAS. My first name is legally Jeffrey. The last person who called me that was my mother, who passed away 2 days before Christmas. But you know, I had two brothers. We all had initials with the middle name A, and we were Jazz, Daz, and Raz. And that's just where that came from. So,
well, there you go. And now I know. I've always been curious, and it took me until now to finally ask that question. All right. So I'm glad to know that we've got that settled. Now, listen, you've got a piece at Hot Air, wrote it over the weekend. This was really interesting. You talk about the rarely discussed support for the Second Amendment among black voters, right? You say that this is a topic which is all too readily broken down among racial lines. If you get all your news from cable TV or the New York Times, they want to the media, I think, has a vested interest in portraying gun ownership as something that old rural white guys do. That's right.
Exactly. And granted, if we want to just sit there and play the demographics game, you will find more support demographically among whites and also Hispanics. But it's not like it's non-existent amongst black voters. And back in the height of the Brady Bill days in the early 90s, support for gun control, or gun rights, I should say, amongst black voters had cratered. It was down around 17 or 18%. But just as of last year, it had actually climbed up to above a third. It was at 35 or 36, according to the Pew rolling poll they do every year for the last 20 years or so. And it's kind of been following the support for gun rights amongst all demographic groups, and it was climbing. And I cited one interview that showed up in a few places, of all places. NPR was one of them that ran it, with one family who were living in the District of Columbia and made the choice when they were buying a home to buy their home outside of the district and go someplace with slightly more liberal laws, because you could not own a handgun in particular. It was hard to get a gun of any sort in D.C. had made that choice. And they talked very passionately about the fact that too many black citizens live in low-income urban areas where crime is very high.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the one place you'd want to be able to defend your house, because the cops can't be everywhere. And my whole point, Cam, was that this isn't a black story or a white story or a Hispanic story or an Asian story. That's true for everyone. I mean, there's only so many police. And if you live in a very high crime area, you want to at least be able to defend your home. And they made a very convincing argument that it's like, you know, if I live someplace like Central City, Baltimore, by the time I call the cops and they get there, I might already be dead.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, there was actually a story a couple of months ago, Chicago Sun-Times, back in July, and they looked at the top five zip codes for concealed carry permits in Chicago. And what they found was that the top five zip codes include zip codes in which there are a lot of police living, but also a lot of high crime zip codes had high rates of concealed carry holders, which is exactly what you're talking about, Jazz. You know, even in the worst of neighborhoods, you've got more good people living there than bad. you've got more people who you know, want to just go through their day and not have any problems than those who want to create problems for their community. And part of the problem is, you know, look, for decades in the city of Chicago, you couldn't legally own a handgun, much less get a concealed carry license. Same holds true right now in Washington, D.C. You're going to have to pay hundreds of extra dollars in government fees if you want to own a gun, and you're not going to get a concealed carry license. You're not going to get a concealed carry license living in Baltimore, Maryland. You're not going to get a concealed carry license living in Camden, New Jersey, or in New York City. Or, you know, this is, I think, a real issue because there are people living in every one of those cities who would like to be able to defend themselves. They have a right to keep and bear arms, and yet the laws are set up in such a way that they are, if not outright prohibited from doing so, strongly discouraged by the law and by their local government from attempting to become a gun owner or a concealed carry holder.
There's a disconnect when you try to pigeonhole these things into you try to racially segregate them. My brother lives in Connecticut, and he's not in one of the really ritzy areas out in a rural area, but Connecticut is really big on gun control laws, but he knows and travels and does business with a lot of folks who live in areas where the crime rate compared to anywhere in an inner city and very high poverty areas is negligible. It's a lot of single family homes. They have a good ratio of number of police to the number of residents. They're out there. They're protected. These are people voting for gun control laws. Well, they're not the ones that are getting their houses broken into regularly, you know, and they really don't have that much to worry about. If they would only travel about 1 hour away into some areas where, you know, there are tremendous crime problems, limited number of police, it's like, but how do you break through to the people with that mindset that, okay, you had one mass shooting, let's say, or the occasional robbery, but for the most part, nobody's threatening you. There are a lot of people in this country who are living in areas where they are under very real threats all the time, and there just aren't enough cops. And you dial 911, they're going to do their best, but it's going to take a while. And so, yeah, I think this all dials back to the situation I was talking about. There are a lot of people who are law-abiding citizens. They could be black, white, pink, green with yellow spots, who would like to be able to at least make sure somebody doesn't bust down their door and just take their house over without being able to defend themselves.
Absolutely. And you know, look, I think that we have to make that argument. We have to talk about the ways that these prohibitions and these gun control laws impact the law-abiding, those who either are currently gun owners or those who want to be gun owners. But I think we also have to talk about the ineffectiveness of the gun control laws when they are put in place to actually reduce violent crime. I mean, you talk about your brother living in Connecticut. They passed, you know, sweeping gun control in 2013. I'm looking at a story from the Hartford Courant less than a month ago. Murders and shootings up in Hartford in 2015. 63% increase in homicides in Hartford from 2014, more than the city has experienced in any year since 2009. Shootings, 143 shootings in 2015, a 32% increase from 2014, more than any year in the last five. Meanwhile, almost every other crime at the same level that it was or slightly reduced from 2014. These gun control laws that are put in place, these are not public safety laws, Jazz. These are gun control laws, and they're controlling the legal gun ownership of Americans.
Well, here's a news flash for the people that are passing these laws. The people out there with the guns that are performing all the acts that you are describing in those statistics that are released by the government every single year are not going out and going to Walmart or, you know, the Dick's Sporting Goods or anything like that and passing a background check and buying a gun. They really, amazingly, I know this is amazing to many people, if you're willing to go out and kill and rape people and steal their things, you're generally not going to be put off by thinking, oh, wait, I didn't have the right paperwork to get my gun, so I guess I won't do that.
I don't know why this doesn't sink in with people. If you are not afraid to commit all these other crimes, you're probably not going to be deterred by, uh-oh, I need a permit.
No, you're probably not going to be dissuaded. But, you know, again, I mean, I think part of the problem is that we are not too many politicians, too many of the anti-gun advocates, you know, they're not interested in having a real conversation about this. They want to promote their gun control laws, but they want to do it under the guise of public safety. I think they think it's a better sell if you can say that the American public is going to be made safer because of these laws than, you know, making the case of, all right, well, listen, we're going to pass these laws. Probably it's not going to do much for the crime rate. But you know what? It's going to be harder to be a gun owner. And eventually, Jazz, if we just break American culture of that idea that it is okay to be a gun owner, then maybe we'll see the number of guns in this country decline. And with fewer guns, there'll be less crime.
Well, I'd like to see the number of illegally owned guns decline to zero. I think you would probably agree with that. But I do hope that articles like this and a little bit more public education will make people realize this is not a racial issue. This is not, oh, guns are good for white people and they're bad for black people. Legally owned guns versus illegally owned guns, that transcends racial lines, religious lines, gender lines, the entire thing. And the more people that we get to be aware, like that one article I referenced, where there are people of every race who are concerned about defending their home and perhaps living in an area where there is higher crime, that you need that opportunity. You need that constitutionally mandated opportunity. And that actually makes you a less desirable target for criminals. And there's people out there who know this. The problem is the media doesn't talk about it.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I'm glad you're talking about it, Jazz, and I'm glad we had a chance to get you on the program, sir. Hopefully we can do this again very soon.
Anytime, my friend.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Jazz Shah joining us from Hot Air here on NRA News, Cam and Company. And again, it's look at the Second Amendment. Look at all of the Bill of Rights. Look at every one of those amendments spelling out to Congress. These are areas in the lives of citizens where you cannot go. And there is nothing in there. There's no asterisk or caveat that says, unless we're talking about an area with a high population density. Unless we are talking about a zip code or a neighborhood where the crime is high and the per capita income rate is low, then you can start messing around with people's rights. It is the right of all Americans to keep and bear arms. And that right doesn't go away because you live in a city. It doesn't go away because you live in a neighborhood with a high violent crime rate. As a matter of fact, that right is more important than ever if you live in a place with a lot of violent crime. That's going to do it for this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in to today's show.